Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Being black in America is like a plane load, a jumbo jet load of black people with nothing but black people in it, falling out the sky. Everyone in the plane is killed every day of every year.
What? Wow. Wow.
So that's what I mean. That the health disparities is not just some, oh, you know, we have a little bit more diabetes, we have a little bit more, we have more HIV. You know, in fact, I think the disease model of dealing is dilutes the fact that black people are dying from everything more than white people, and it's not related to class.
Maybe just knowing that someone else has experienced racial discrimination is bad for your health. Provocative new research raises that possibility. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein explains.
Doctors have known for a long time that African Americans are more likely than whites to suffer from many diseases, including high blood pressure. Connie Mulligan of the University of Florida wanted to know how racial discrimination may be playing a role in that.
Discrimination has been studied a lot for its effect on mental health. It's been less studied for its effect on physical health, something like blood pressure.
So Mulligan and her colleagues studied more than 150 African Americans living in Tallahassee. They analyzed their genes, measured their blood pressure, and quizzed them about their experiences with racial discrimination.
Things got really interesting when we found that many, many people, well over half the people, would talk about experiences of discrimination that they themselves had not had, but that people close to them had. Their significant other, their parents, their kids, their friends, coworkers, that sort of thing.
So the researchers looked at whether that kind of secondhand discrimination had any relationship to their blood pressure and to their genes.
What we found is a whole new class of genes that seem to interact with when people close to you are exposed to unfair treatment. That puts the individual at higher risk for high blood pressure.
Genes that had already been shown to possibly play a role in emotional problems such as depression, anxiety, and stress. Now, Mulligan doesn't know why secondhand discrimination would do this to people carrying these genes, but she has some theories.
It may be more distressful to hear about bad experiences happening to people close to you than experiencing them yourself. You might think, well, I'm tough. I can handle it. You know, I can handle whatever life throws at me. But, you know, don't you do anything to my little girl.
Mulligan isn't saying that other factors aren't important. Blacks have a harder time just getting access to good medical care than whites, for example. But Mulligan says the new findings suggest that there's more than that going on.
What I think is really exciting about our study is this idea of interactions between genetics and something like discrimination. That opens a whole new window in what might be causing racial disparities in disease.
Now, some researchers are skeptical that Mulligan has made the case that these newly identified genes are really interacting with secondhand discrimination to affect blood pressure. And even if it turns out that that's true, Troy Duster of the University of California, Berkeley, questions how helpful that is.
I don't see how this study helps us understand what anyone might do If it's simply, quote, a matter of genetic associations with perceived stress, what's the implication? That you want to perceive less stress?
But others argue the research provides an important new way to think about discrimination and health. Thomas McDade is an anthropologist at Northwestern.
The study contributes to a growing body of research suggesting that unfair treatment and discrimination are important sources of stress, and that these stressors have real physical health implications. So if we care about improving people's health, then one way to go is to try to reduce the burdens of stress and unfair treatment.
But it's clear that a lot more research is needed to better understand the relationship between racial discrimination, genetics, and health. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Everything that I did, different things I was told, just ended up being food for my soul.
Well, it's your soul food. Well, good old-fashioned soul food. All right.
Africa's population will soar to more than 4 billion by 2100, nearly a billion of those people in one country alone, Nigeria.
Customs officials in Nigeria have managed to stop a large quantity of fake rice from being sold in local markets. They've impounded sacks filled with what looks like rice, but is in fact plastic. When I spoke to our Nigeria correspondent, Martin Patience, I asked him if there was any real rice in the product or if it was all just plastic.
I don't know, and the customs officials don't know because neither of us ate it. What we do know, and I touched this rice, it feels like rice, but when you actually smell it, there's a faint chemical odour. And the customs officials told me when they tried to cook it, it was too sticky, it kind of melted, it was like melted plastic.
It does not taste, it does not look, it does not smell like rice. You know, as an African, if you have a rice in your soya, you eat rice, you know how it feels. This is the first time we are seeing this.
And they say they've sent a sample, a batch of this rice, or so-called rice, fake rice, to the laboratories, and they're waiting to hear back.
So where's it come from?
Again, it's another one of the big questions. We know it was imported to the country. We know the authorities here got a tip-off from a journalist, and they raided a storage unit in Lagos, and they found more than 2.5 tons of this rice. Rice is a staple of Nigerian cuisine. It's coming up for Christmas, so people go out and buy bags of rice. So it does appear that these businessmen, one of whom has been arrested, wanted to offload this rice to Christmas shoppers. But we're not sure exactly where it came from. China may be one of the places that might get fingered.
How common are food scandals in Nigeria?
Not very common. I mean, when you compare it to China, I was in China for 5 years and there was fake meat, fake eggs, even fake apple stores if we move away from food stuff. In Nigeria, food scandals, thankfully, are rare. What we do see is other kind of scandals. The big scandal in Nigeria is fake pharmaceuticals. Perhaps as many as thousands of people die a year from taking fake drugs. So this is the key problem. But the authorities now say they're on the lookout for more fake food.
Martin Patience in Lagos.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about? In Europe and in Germany. He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? White genetic annihilation. All these people from Syria coming up in here.
We're going to take a look now at the political reaction to the attack on the Berlin Christmas market. There is a tense debate in Germany over admitting migrants and refugees from countries like Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And while much about the attacker is still unknown, Chancellor Angela Merkel said today that it would be particularly difficult for Germans to bear if it turns out that the perpetrator was among those refugees.
Dies wäre besonders widerwärtig gegenüber den vielen, vielen Deutschen, die tagtäglich...
It would be especially repugnant to the many, many Germans who are committed to helping refugees every day, Merkel said, and to the many people who actually need our help and who are trying to integrate into our country. We're going to hear now from Stefan Cornelius. He's with the newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. He joins us via Skype from Munich. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do you make of Angela Merkel coming out so quickly, well before ISIS claimed responsibility, say, for this even, to the issue of refugees?
Well, Angela Merkel was trying to preempt the debate, which she certainly did, but she will be framed now by this shadow, which basically blames her for inviting those people to Germany and by inviting them bringing in danger and threats to the German public. Even though this argument is extremely shortcut and wrong, if you ask me, it sticks and it frames us the campaign, which actually starts next year, the campaign for federal elections. And so Angela Merkel is out to fight for her re-election.
What have been some other reactions to this attack in Berlin from German politicians?
Quite honestly, most reactions were calm and considerate. There was no blaming going on, apart from two camps. And those are the right-wing populist camps, first of all, the newly founded and now very strong AfD party, which is trying to make its way into the federal parliament next year. And the second one is a sister party of Angela Merkel's conservative party, the Bavarian CSU. And the prime minister and party chairman of that party, Horst Seehofer, is a very staunch critique of Merkel, and he's trying to bypass her on the right.
You also mentioned the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, farther right. I gather that one politician from that group tweeted today about Merkel's dead, blaming the victims of the Berlin attack on the chancellor.
That will be their line of argument for the next months to come. This is an argument which probably goes down with, let's say, 12 to 16% of the German electorate. This is what they want to achieve in the federal elections next year. And Merkel's plan, actually, to avoid this entire debate, to leave the refugee issue behind her and point to larger issues around the threats from Russia, the uncertainty in the world, the new change in American government, the Syrian crisis, this will all probably fold now, and Germany turns back inwardly into this nasty debate on how many migrants can the country actually sustain.
When you speak of as big as 16% of the electorate favoring the kind of policies of the alternative party, does that mean that for a sizable chunk of the German population, nationalism, nativism are okay now?
Well, Germany is not immune against this kind of thinking and tendencies. So definitely populism is on the rise in Germany. The beauty of Germany is that the system is very strong and not immune, but it can fend off most of this populism. So the party system cannot be taken over by one populist leader alone. The political system is fabricated in a way that you have to form coalitions, and those coalitions have to be mostly led by moderate people. So I think the German system is very strong and can endure that kind of populism.
Stefan Cornelius of the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. This ain't a damn thing changed. Let me explain. Now, since people of color are genetically dominant and Caucasoids are genetically recessive, if whites expect to be predominant, meaning survive as a race, then they simply must take precautions. That's why they're worried about the future now.
With the Electoral College busy making Donald Trump's win official today, we want to look at some of the dynamics this election has unleashed. Those include a resurgence of nationalism and populism, a sense for some that the America they've known and loved is slipping away. And as their candidate likes to say, they just want to take their country back. Plenty of folks on the conservative side of the political spectrum in Europe feel much the same way. And that is absolutely the case with a new far-right protest group in Germany, as The World's Matthew Bell reports from Berlin.
An ambulance makes its way through a traffic jam at Hermannplatz. The plaza at the corner of Karl Marx and Hermann Streets takes its name right out of German history. Hermann the German, as he's known, is the great tribal warrior who fought the Romans at the dawn of the first century. But when native Berliner Robert Timm looks around this part of the city now, he tells me he worries about Germany's future. That's because he says pretty much everyone he sees is a foreigner.
You really have to look for Germans around here. This is an area where I would not want to live, and I also wouldn't want my kids to grow up here. Almost every district has one of these places these days. And that deeply troubles me. And if I look at how many people have arrived lately and how many people we are expecting to arrive in the future, we have no idea how to integrate them, really. It's a big, big problem in the future, I think.
Tim is one of the leaders of the Identitaire Bewegung, or the Identitarian Movement. It started in France, caught on in Austria, and about 8 months ago, Robert Tim got involved with the group here in Germany. He's a 25-year-old college student studying architecture with a hipster beard and glasses. I sat down to talk with him at a German restaurant on the outskirts of the former East Berlin, where he grew up. He says the Identitarians are part of a new right here.
We consider ourselves patriots. We're just trying to make sure that the country stays like it used to be.
Donald Trump's expression is "Make America Great Again." Mm-hmm. Is it similar?
We're trying to play with his rhetoric now, I think. So yeah, there are jokes are being made about "Make Europe Great Again."
But is it for you? Would you say it's a similar thing of "Make Germany Great Again"?
No, because in a historical viewpoint, that expression does not really work out, and we should be relatively careful with it. Yeah, because people get some nasty associations if we say "make Germany great again."
As in Nazi Germany, he prefers to say something like "make Germany stay Germany." Tim and his fellow identitarians say they reject core elements of the neo-Nazi and extreme far-right ideology. Take anti-Semitism, for instance. Jews have a place here in Germany, Tim says. And if someone who hates Jews or denies the Holocaust tries to join his group, they would not be welcome. Tim says the Identitarians are also different from the so-called alt-right in America.
We don't believe in white supremacy, but we do believe that every nation has its own culture, and that's something we should hold on to, and that comes along with strict laws on immigration. Has nothing to do with supremacy. It's something we don't want to be involved with.
In this slickly produced YouTube video, identitarians from southern Germany are shown chanting, "Home, freedom, tradition, stop multiculturalism." Then comes a series of close-ups of white, mostly blue-eyed Germans talking about things they don't like: globalism, political correctness, and the left. The Identitarians in Germany are not a political party, though they would tend to support the far-right Alternative for Germany party. This is a movement fueled by emotion, and their favorite mode of expression are political stunts. In August, they climbed the Brandenburg Gate, waved their yellow and black flags, and put up a banner that said, "Secure the borders, save lives." Here's Robert Tim talking about the single most important issue for the Identitarians.
I'm completely all right with controlled immigration, and I think there are many people that have the right to be here because they're being pursued in their country and there's war and all that. But all this has to work under very strict circumstances. And still, it has to be ensured that Germans stay the majority in Germany.
Whenever the Identitarians hold a protest, protesters from the left often show up to chant against them.
One in English, for example, said loud, said clear, "Refugees are welcome here." There's also one, one screams, "Nazis, Nazis, Nazis," and then "Raus, raus, raus." So everybody screams "out, out, out," and then "Nazis out, Nazis out." I like that one, too.
That's 18-year-old Rosa, who didn't want to give her last name, also from Berlin. She says the Identitarians are just a newer, younger, more social media savvy version of the same old far-right extremists in German politics. And she says they're dangerous.
There's, for example, there's a video they made. While watching it, I got
goosebumps.
Goosebumps, yes. And because it was so, "We are Germans and this is our country and we are so proud," and it's so, so, it makes me feel very uncomfortable.
Rosa says when the Identitarians talk about closing the borders, they're sort of revealing themselves to be racists and neo-Nazis in disguise. That assessment comes as no surprise to Werner Patzelt. He's a professor at the Technical University of Dresden who tracks far-right populism in Germany, and he says the political left and right in Europe are so divided, they just talk past each other.
The young persons among identitarians are trying to make clear that one can be willing to preserve distinct Polish, French, German culture without being a Nazi. On the other hand, those from the left side of the political spectrum do not believe in that. They would claim that identitarians only pretend to be, so to speak, enemies of really right-wing extremists, but actually they are in sympathy with them.
Potzold says the identitarians in Germany have not been around long enough to judge whether they are a genuinely dangerous extremist group. But one thing that just about everyone in Germany I've talked to, left, right, and center, seems to agree on, that the far-right AfD party, the favorite of the identitarians, is poised to win a lot of seats in next year's national election. For The World, Matthew Bell, Berlin.
The whites are furious. Never seen anything like it. I haven't seen white people this mad since the O.J. verdict. There's a split screen with white people on both sides. Ah! Now, I'm not saying I'm enjoying it. I'm just saying I've never seen this before. I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
Since the beginning of November, OPB has been airing a series of stories about race and identity in the Northwest. We've heard from multiracial Oregonians, a West African immigrant, a white man who says he feels like a minority as a rural Republican, and more. Anna Griffin is a news director here and the guiding force behind this series, and she joins me now. Good to have you here.
Hi, Dave. Good to be here.
What was the idea behind this series?
You know, it seems like a lifetime ago, but if you remember this summer, there were the police shootings in Minneapolis and Baton Rouge. There were police officers then shot in Dallas and Baton Rouge. The rhetoric in the presidential campaign was very hot and heavy, especially from the Trump campaign about race and Muslims and all that. And it struck us in the newsroom that the conversation about race was heated and unusually polarizing and very us versus them. And it was time to try to have some conversations about that that felt more civilized and thoughtful.
How did the series evolve as you worked on it editorially and started, you know, getting a list of people together that you wanted to talk to?
Well, it actually started this summer with our two great summer interns, Mira Powell and Shirley Chan from the University of Oregon. And I asked them to go out and talk in particular to communities of color about racism. And realized pretty quickly they did great work, but I realized it was an editing failure on my part because I had asked kind of a very white question, you know, tell me how the color of your skin makes your life more difficult. And so this fall, we used our Public Insight Network. We reached out to some advocacy organizations. We solicited online on social media people to just, let's just talk about race, just tell us stories about race, not necessarily about racism that clearly comes into it, but about the role race plays in your life.
Let's hear some of the voices, starting with Aissatou Diallo.
Sure. Aissatou is a lovely young woman from Gambia, the country in West Africa, who came to the United States to study at Portland Community College. She also works with other immigrants at the advocacy group IRCO. That's how I met her. And she is a Muslim, and she wears a headscarf. And when she came to the U.S., many of her friends back in Africa said, you need to take that off. That's going to get you in trouble. And she thought that was ridiculous. But it turns out, as she told us, people notice.
I was coming to work in the morning. I was standing at the 82nd Avenue MAX station, and this guy walked up to me and he asked me if I knew who Saddam Hussein or who Bin Laden was. And I've only heard about these people in the news, so it was very disturbing. And he kept on walking towards me, approaching me, yelling and screaming, you go back to Islam or something like that. I thought he was going to punch me or something. I was really scared. I was just waiting for him to snap and do something. And there were people around there and no one walked up to say, stop what you're doing. That left in my mind, what if I was white and what if I was a white girl standing there and someone was approaching me, would it have been different? Would people have stopped him?
You know, did you ask her if things like that made her think twice about wearing a headscarf?
I did. And she said that she has thought about taking it off, but that really doesn't – she has a very deep faith, and that doesn't feel right to her. She's thought about tying it in different ways so it's not so obviously a sign of her faith, but that also doesn't feel – that just doesn't feel right to her. She wants to be who she is.
I know that one of the interviews you did that generated a fair number of comments on social media, it was with Jordan Lund. Who is he?
Jordan is – he describes himself as the quintessential Portland white guy. He is kind of a big guy. He's got a beard. He was wearing plaid when I interviewed him. He works in tech downtown. He's a Bernie Sanders voter who didn't love Hillary because he didn't think she was liberal enough. And he told me that as a white progressive, he wishes he knew more people of color. And what really set some folks off on social media was that – that's not so surprising. Oregon is a 87% white. But he said he doesn't really understand why Black Lives Matter protesters protest in downtown Portland. He has a view of Oregon and Portland in particular as an incredibly progressive place. But the story that he told me was of sort of having that bubble in his head shattered a few years ago when he went out of town and talked about Portland to someone else.
I used to work for a company that caused me to spend half my time in Portland and half my time in the Chicago area, which is very different from Portland in a lot of respects. I was taking a cab to get around, and talking with the cabbie, it came out that I was from Portland. And the very first thing he asked me was, "Portland, huh? You don't have much trouble with black people there, do you?" I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to react. My brain started turning over. This is the first thing people say about my city, the city that I love and won't move from. So I said, you know, you're right. I know both of them, and they're pretty good people.
You know, it's interesting. I think people who study history understand, Dave, that Oregon has some real racist public policies in its past that are part of the reason that we're so unbelievably white. But for Lund, part of why this encounter in Chicago with a cabbie shocked him was he sees that as just being in the distant, distant past. And I think it's a very different perspective from what you hear from a lot of people of color for whom that is still real and everyday.
If you're just tuning in, this is Think Out Loud. We're talking right now with OPB News Director Anna Griffin, who's been working for the last 2 months or so on a series of conversations for OPB about race and identity. Can you introduce us to another person you talked to?
Sure. I talked to a young woman named Jasmine Westmoreland, who is a student at Portland State. She's one of the heads of their black student group. She is of mixed race and proudly of mixed race. She has sort of lovely cocoa brown skin, and she gets asked all the time, are you Cuban? Are you Argentinian? What are you? And she very proudly says, I'm white and black. You know, I have a white mother and a black father. And one of the things that is interesting is she grew up in Coos Bay, very white city. And when she came to Portland, she really embraced the African-American side of her family more. But she's marrying a white guy, or she did marry a white guy this fall, which has led to some really intense internal conversations for her about the life she's going to lead and how she's going to raise her kids if they ever have them.
We talk about race a lot, actually, and it's kind of something that we have to agree to disagree on. You know, we both have different views. I'm like, you do realize your child is going to be black. He's like, you do realize that they will end up being more white than black, though. And I understand that, too. And one thing that has been kind of a funny little, not really argument, but I would like my kids to be at least somewhat close to my skin color because I don't want to look like the nanny. I've told him before that in a way I wish that he was black so I could come home and we could relate to the same struggles and talk about that. But then in another way, I'm really happy that he's not because I don't want to have to worry about his life when he leaves the house.
One of the big themes that really came out, and you can sort of hear it there and just in a lot of the other stories, is that racial or ethnic identity, it's so much more complicated and fluid and individual than any box anybody could check on, you know, on say, a census form.
One of the most interesting stories I heard was from a guy named John Mehta. John is a cider maker and software developer and Renaissance man in Hood River, and he grew up thinking he was mixed race too. His mother's white, and his father's side of the family talked about being African American and Native American. While they were very proud of the Native American side of the family, they really downplayed the black side. His father would get on him about talking too black and acting too black. But a few years ago, Mehta and his siblings got very curious, and they did some blood tests, and they discovered there was no Native American blood in them at all. They were black. unlike Westmoreland, who really proudly embraces being mixed race, Mehta has made a really different decision about what he calls himself.
Knowing what I know about how my family deals with their children, I totally think that they were thinking about their children, not so much themselves. They wanted them to be better. And better is such a judgment, because better meant whiter, you know. I'm just black at this point. Just black. Just black. Just black. Just black.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Racially charged incidents over the past few months. Now the Oregon City School District is dealing with a brand new controversy.
The latest involves several Oregon City high school students who recorded a video in which they hurl racial epithets, many of which are directed at the school's principal.
K2 Stephen Mayer joins us now live from Oregon City High School. And Stephen, what are the students in the video saying about all this?
Well, Steve and Deb, none of the students involved in that video would do an on-camera interview with us today, but I did speak with one of them in person. He says he's really sorry about everything. Another mother was in tears as she told me her son made a horrible mistake, a mistake she says they all wish they could take back. It's a video many find disturbing, so much so we had to censor most of what was said.
What about your home mobile to f***ing ranch is 5 a day come new to the school on OCHS. What do you think about that training bathroom?
In the video, these students were referring to Oregon City High School principal Tom Lavelle. He even responded to the video on Twitter saying, exactly the type of negative behavior we are trying to stop. It won't be tolerated. There will be severe consequences for this. The video first made the rounds on Snapchat, where former Oregon City High School student Marcus Hassan saw it. He knew he had to do something. How did it make you feel when you first saw it?
It made me feel kind of sick because nobody should be using that word.
So Marcus posted the video to Twitter. Since then, it's gotten more than 100 retweets and sparked an online discussion on how the boys should be punished, if at all. The issue hits close to home for Marcus. His girlfriend told us in October how a racist note was left at her house after she wore a Black Lives Matter shirt to school. She says the note said, "Go back to picking cotton with the N-word."
Nigga!
It adds, "Black lives doesn't matter."
When I saw the video, I just felt like I needed to post it because all the racist stuff that's been going around in OC, and I don't think, like, everybody really knows what that word means and why they shouldn't be saying that.
But just a day before, Marcus's girlfriend says she was targeted, this picture went viral, leading to a walkout by students at the school. This picture shows several students holding a sign reading, "Welcome back to the farm," N-word. Then in November, 15-year-old Joy Simmons, a freshman at the Clackamas Academy of Industrial Sciences in Oregon City, told our Joe Douglas how she found two racist notes stuffed into her binder. Marcus says this never happened when he went to school a few years ago. He hopes these students learn from their mistakes.
I feel like it's just that these kids don't really feel like they know what they're doing and they think it's okay.
And the parents of one of the boys involved sent us a lengthy statement reading in part, "The incredible lack of respect displayed for Principal Lavelle and others in that video is deplorable. The abhorrent views expressed in that video are not consistent with the values we live by or teach our children." Now, we also got a long statement from the school district as well, talking about possible punishment these kids could be facing. You can read both those statements in full on our website, KATU News, KATU.com. Reporting live tonight, Stephen Mayer, KATU.
All right, Steve.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race. So we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
Rectifying racial tensions. Hundreds of people pack an auditorium in Howard County tonight to have some candid discussion after several racist incidents involving high schoolers. WJZ is live. Abijoy Brennan has more on how the community is trying to reassure students who are afraid inside their own classrooms. Abijoy?
Denise, good evening. Howard County is known for its diversity, so this is not the type of situation they are proud of. But tonight, hundreds of people took a stand against what's been bubbling in their backyard.
A county in the spotlight for the wrong reasons stood up at a town hall Tuesday night to condemn recent incidents of racism in its schools.
I personally feel disappointed.
I just think that a lot of the things that they talk about, like, they don't really think before they say, and I think that that's a problem.
The school system has been grappling with offensive posts on social media for months.
They're an inferior race.
A Mount Hebron student's racist tirade went viral. At Appleton High School in Columbia, a student posted a picture in blackface and used a racial slur.
Nigga!
Over at River Hill High in Clarksville, another incident where a student posted an image of a gun and a racial slur.
And then earlier this month, students here at Oakland Mills High School staged a walkout in protest. Some said they didn't feel safe after a fellow classmate posted a note online using the N-word.
Nigga!
For the incidents where students were the perpetrators, Congressman Elijah Cummings said there is hope.
And so what we try to do is give them some lessons about things we wish we knew when we were their age, and hopes that they will grab a hold of some of that and take it into their classrooms.
As the community tries to counteract the offensive rhetoric online,
it's easy to hide behind social media.
Parents are calling on other parents to do a better job.
Too often when we ignore them, social media grabs hold and they get other messages from society that I think sometimes are pretty negative.
Several community groups, including church leaders and rabbis, helped to organize tonight's event. And their main goal, Denise, was just to listen to the concerns that people have. Reporting live tonight, Abijoy Brennan, WJZ Eyewitness News.
Listening is always good. Thank you, Abijoy. Now, some have been pushing for details on the consequences the students who used racial slurs will face. But because of privacy restrictions, the school system is not allowed to reveal that information.
As a Charlestown parent, how do you feel about busing, and what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I don't think it'll go over here, not at all. And I think when they do take some of the police out of here, there'll be more trouble than anyone realizes. Because these kids are not going to stand for it, neither are the parents.
How about attendance? How do you feel school attendance will be as the year goes on?
All colored, no white, not in our schools. Yeah, give it to the
nigga.
That's what they want.
For more than 60 years now, since Brown versus Board of Education, federal courts have kept an eye on specific school districts across this country with a history of segregation. One of those is the Jefferson County School District, just outside Birmingham, Alabama. And it is now up to a federal judge to decide whether a predominantly white city within the district can secede from its larger majority black system and start its own. Cheryl Wheeler-Stort from member station WBHM reports.
That mostly white city is Gardendale, Alabama, where Friday nights are ruled by high school football. The schools here in Gardendale are among the best performing in Jefferson County. But being the best in Jefferson County isn't enough for Mayor Stan Hoagland.
As the mayor of the city, you know, I'm not all-knowing, I don't pretend to be, but students perform better in city-run systems.
He wants out of the county system, and so do a lot of people in Gardendale. That was clear 3 years ago when city residents voted to increase their own property taxes to start a school district of their own.
You know, if we had our own system with a local superintendent and a local board that lives in town that you see when you go shopping or at church, maybe a little more accountability.
But it isn't as easy as that. In 1971, African Americans sued the district for segregating black and white students and won. Since then, the federal courts have always had the final say on any movement in and out of the district. And soon, the federal judge in this case will decide if this is another move to segregate.
Nobody has ever said anything to me about the real reason why they want to form the district.
That's Craig Pouncey, the superintendent of Jefferson County Schools.
Diversity actually builds strength, in my opinion, because it opens people's minds. And I've seen where our schools, particularly in the last 2 years, have really thrived on that diversity.
He says that diversity, additional money, and even access to some special programs all go out the window with Gardendale.
I don't fault a municipality from wanting those things, but we have to be very mindful of the overall impacts.
Impact, too, on hundreds of students who take advantage of specialized classes Gardendale Schools offers to kids from around the county. Students like 11th grader Devontae Kirkland. He makes the 25-minute trek every day from the high school near his home in Northeast Jefferson County to Gardendale for an auto take class.
Yeah, you loosen it up just a little bit. And
students dry. Hover around a car as Devontae is focused on changing the oil.
Let it dry. There you go.
After he graduates, he hopes to go to school at Alabama State University, but likes this class because he wants to know how to work on his own car when he gets one. He's also making friends, some who don't look like him, some who come from other parts of the county.
Sometimes we see each other out of school, and we talk in school, too. So, and I'm learning something new from them every day.
But students like Devontae wouldn't have access to Gardendale if it leaves the county system. City leaders there have tried to make the case they aren't segregating by allowing about 700 black students to remain in the new majority white system, even though they live outside city limits. The federal judge will soon decide whether that would make the new district truly desegregated. For NPR News, I'm Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart in Jefferson County, Alabama.
It's been 30 years since her son was chased to his death in Howard Beach. But to Michael Griffith's mother, the events of that night are still vivid in her mind, and the pain of losing her son is still very raw.
When someone takes a part of your life away from you, it never goes away. You always feel that pain. It's never goes away.
Griffith was one of three men who were attacked by a mob of white teens after their car broke down and they stopped at a pizza shop in Howard Beach. Griffith was chased into traffic and was hit by a car on the Belt Parkway. His friend Timothy Grimes managed to get away while another man, Cedric Sandiford, was severely beaten. The incident rocked the city and created a racial firestorm as protests erupted.
Thousands of people marched. Thousands of people fought. We knew that Black Lives Matter. In 1986.
Leading the protest was the Reverend Al Sharpton, who reunited with Griffith's mother at an event to honor and remember the 23-year-old. Charles Hines also attended the event. The former Brooklyn district attorney was the special prosecutor in the case. It was Sharpton's first big civil rights fight. His protests with other civil rights leaders put him in the national spotlight. Three men were eventually convicted, but the marches highlighted racial tensions.
Gangs of people came out in the streets in Howard Beach calling us the N-word.
Nigga!
Throwing things at us. And that is what began to shake the city, to see the raw racism.
Griffith's family say they have forgiven his attackers, but they can't forget what happened, and they don't want other New Yorkers to forget either.
It's not to say that everyone in Howard Beach was bad, because there were some people who helped Cedric that night. But it's just unfortunate that it happened, and it happened to my brother.
In Brooklyn, Rochelle Boone, New York 1.
A faulty ballistics test and an overeager prosecution sent Anthony Ray Hinton to death row in 1985. It took 16 years of fighting by lawyer Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative to get him released in April of 2015. Stevenson says the battle for America's soul is now taking place in cases like this in the U.S. criminal justice system. That system kept Anthony Ray Hinton in a 5x7 cell waiting for his execution day for a crime he didn't commit for nearly 30 years. He was sentenced to death after being convicted of the murders of two restaurant managers. Hinton is 59 now. He was 29 at the time of his conviction, and he remembers vividly how he was mowing the lawn at his mother's house in Birmingham on a hot July day when the police showed up.
On that particular day, I was imagining getting through with cutting the grass. It was very hot in July, and going in the house, taking a shower, and later on, my church was having our yearly revival, and that's what I had looked forward to later on that evening, was going to revival and hearing the word of God. But something dramatic happened, and it changed the way I see the justice system. It changed the way I trust people. It just helped scarred me for life. I really believe that.
What did you think that your life would be before the police came to get you? What did you dream of being? What did you imagine you would do?
Well, you know, like I think, like most people, I dream of perhaps getting married, starting a family, just being a productive citizen, and more of all, treat people with respect and dignity. You know, I think it's a tragedy. I think the world passes you by. No one said, we're going to wait on Anthony Ray Hinton and see how his case turned out. The world kept going. All these places kept going. And I just wanted a life that quietness and peaceful and doing my job as a citizen of this country and providing for my family.
And can you describe what life is like on death row?
Oh, it's exactly what it say, death row. You wakes up every morning with a death sentence over your head. For 30 years, I slept in a 5x7 with my knees in a fetal position. I only had a sink and a toilet, and my bed was mounted to the wall. It is constantly noise 24/7. There is nothing hardly ever good come to death row. But the thing that I can actually say, when you hear men tell you why they there, I think that not only did their parents fail those that didn't provide love and nurturing for them, I think we as a society failed them as well, and we failed them again by sentencing them to death.
Who failed you, Anthony?
The system failed me. The system that I was brought up to believe in. As a little boy, my mom used to always tell me, if you ever lost, try to find a police officer. If you ever need help, find a police officer. They are your friend. And I can remember sitting back watching a little show called Leave It to Beaver, I think it was, and you had this police officer used to be out there on the street directing traffic and showing people which way to go. My mom believed in that, and I believed in it until 1985. I wish I could sit here today and tell you that all polices was like the one that did me, but they're not. There are some good officers out there. There are some good prosecutors out there. There are some people that really believe in the truth. I just happened to run across one that believed that the world should be white, and I believed, ran across one that he was willing to get a conviction at any cost, and that means send his innocent people to death row.
How did you make a full life in your mind when you were on death row? I mean, what did you do inside that head of yours?
Well, you know, it's the first 3 years when I first arrived at death row, I did not speak to a human being for 3 years other than my mother and my best friend when they came to see me. I had this profound hatred for the men that put me there. And all I could do was imagine escaping. And I didn't want to escape to be on the run. I wanted to escape and just come back and choke the life out of those men that did this to me. And after a while, going into my fourth year, since I couldn't escape physically, I decided I would escape mentally. And I looked at my body, and I told my body, I said, the mind is finna leave you. But I promise you, I will be back to check on you from time to time. And with that, I could just hear my body saying, okay, but make sure you come back and check on me. And when I did escape, of all the places that I escaped to, I went to England. For whatever reason, I wanted to talk to the Queen. And I showed up at the palace, and I told the guard that I was there to see Queen Elizabeth. I was able to get into the palace, and I saw Queen Elizabeth, and we had a conversation for hours. And after that, talking to the Queen, I realized then that I was able to take my mind and go wherever I wanted to go.
What did the Queen tell you?
Well, we sit down and we talked about Prince Di, and we talked about Prince Charles and Prince Harry and Prince William. And in that conversation, the Queen, she said, "Mr. Hinton, would you like some tea?" And I said, "Well, of course I would like some tea." And she said, "What would you like in your tea?" And I said, "A spot of lemon, please." And she summoned the butlers to go and get this lemon for my tea. We come back and we begin to talk more about problems in both worlds. And what I learned then, that I had reached out to a lady that didn't know me, but she didn't turn me away. And I reached out to a lady that had compassion. And in that same breath, I realized that I was helping this lady, that one would think that she had the whole world in her hand, but she was lonely. And she welcomed my visit. When I got ready to leave, she looked at me sad. And she said, "Mr. Hinton, do you promise to come back?" And I told the Queen, "Well, of course, I will be back." And since I've been out, I haven't seen the Queen, but I have the privilege of going to England twice. Got a chance to go into the palace, and hopefully I will get a chance to meet the Queen. There is no way one can spend 30 years in this small cell and not be able to escape somehow, some way. Those that wasn't able to escape either hung themselves or they tried to kill themselves. Man, I don't believe was built to spend 30 years inside of a cage. And I would like for those that are listening to just try to imagine being locked up in a 5x7 for 30 years for something you know you didn't do, something that the authority know that you didn't do. So I was not going to give up. My faith would not let me give up. So I had to find a way to escape, and I escaped where it was beautiful, to places that I never would be able to go, even as a free man. I went to everywhere that I could think of, Japan, Singapore. I went to Spain. I mean, wherever I wanted to go, I allowed my mind to take me there. And now I truly understand what it means to read a book. I may not never go to California, but if you can just give me a book, if I can find a book that talks about California, I can read that book and I can imagine being in California. That's how I did my 30 years.
Wait, I think police is at
okay,
the door.
The neighbors think I'm selling dope. I guess the neighbors think I'm selling dope. Selling dope. Neighbors think. I think the neighbors think I'm selling dope. The neighbors think I'm selling dope. Selling dope. Selling dope. Selling dope. Selling dope.
A viral video is causing a firestorm online. It shows an altercation between a Fort Worth police officer and several women who called police for help. The video shows the women yelling at the officer, and after a scuffle, the officer points his taser at them. NBC5's Tim Siesco is live outside the Mansfield jail where the two women are still being held this morning. Tim, what's the latest?
Well, Johnny, I can tell you that right now the attorney for both Jacqueline Craig and Bria Hyman are working to bond their clients out of jail. Bria Hyman is being charged with interfering with public duties. Craig, meanwhile, has been charged with resisting arrest and failure to ID. She's also being held on several outstanding traffic offenses. Their attorney tells us he thinks it's ridiculous they were arrested in the first place. Now, I want to go ahead and show you the video that's caused all of this controversy. Yesterday, Craig called Fort Worth police, claiming that a neighbor had physically grabbed her 7-year-old son for littering. Another woman pulled out her phone and recorded the exchange between Craig and the unnamed officer that responded. In the video, Craig tells the officer she has a problem with the neighbor putting his hands on her son. The officer then says, "Why don't you teach your son not to litter?" which leads to a more intense conversation. Hyman then moves towards the officer, and that's when things get physical. The officer puts both women on the ground, pulls out his taser on them, and arrests them. Now, their attorney, Lee Merritt, says they will begin looking at their options once both women are out of jail.
police department last night that no report was made on the initial report from my client. So we are going to go back and make sure that report does go in. And obviously, we want to see a report filed against this officer.
Now, a short time ago, Fort Worth police put out a brief statement saying they are aware of the video and that an internal affairs investigation is underway. They say they'll put out a more detailed statement.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
Tonight, Channel 9 investigates after we uncovered shocking allegations of racial slurs, fighting, and drunk driving involving two local police officers.
It was egregious enough to me that it bothered me. It upset me.
According to an internal report sent to Channel 9, a Spencer officer and a Salisbury officer let a night on the town get way out of hand.
It comes as Salisbury police work to address trust issues within the community. Eyewitness News reporter Tina Terry investigated and took that document straight to both departments for some answers.
That Salisbury internal document we received reveals testimony from an officer about what happened when he and a Spencer officer got together for a night on the town. On that October night, the Salisbury officer admits drinking six beers and a strong bourbon. At one point, he noticed the Spencer officer needed assistance in being escorted outside and was extremely intoxicated. At times, he says the Spencer officer used racial comments and even the N-word while leaving a bar.
The amount of drinking and then just the racial slurs were problematic for me.
Salisbury Councilmember Kenny Harton says he also received a copy of that leaked report this weekend.
We were notified that this happened as a city council back in October, but it was low on details.
A particularly disturbing part of that report, the Salisbury officer admits, getting behind the wheel of a car. He says he stopped in the roadway to allow the Spencer officer to vomit. That led to a near car crash and fight with a civilian. Eventually, a highway trooper arrived and gave the Salisbury officer a breathalyzer test. The report says he blew a 0.08 and was placed under arrest for DWI. Back at the police department, he was tested again, registering a 0.06. The report says a magistrate found there was no probable cause for the arrest.
I think they need to be suspended, because that ain't right. I mean, they tell us, if you drink, don't drive.
Harton says he shared his concerns with leaders in Salisbury and Spencer.
If they are not adhering to the standards as citizens when they're off, I don't think they should be in a position to hold anyone else accountable.
In Salisbury, Tina Terry, Channel 9, Eyewitness News.
Now, Tina asked the Spencer Town manager if that officer is still employed. He said he wouldn't comment because it's a personnel matter. Salisbury's police chief did send a comment. He said that Salisbury officer is still employed, but there's an internal investigation. Regarding the DWI, he said SPD contacted Highway Patrol to handle the incident, and quote, the SPD did not make the decision on arrest or charges. The trooper and an independent judicial officer, the magistrate, did.
There's nothing more refreshing than having a clear, crisp, clean glass of water on a warm summer's day.
That cool, refreshing drink.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Attorney General Bill Schuette today unveiled a new batch of criminal charges in the Flint water disaster. Charged today are former Flint emergency managers Darnell Early and Jerry Ambrose, along with Flint officials Howard Croft, he was superintendent of public works, and utilities administrator Dorothy Johnson. This brings the total number of people charged by Schuette to 13. Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning is back with us again. Peter, the two EMs, Darnell Early and Jerry Ambrose, charged with false pretenses and conspiracy. These are both 20-year felonies, along with misconduct in office and willful neglect of duty. But doesn't the state's emergency manager law protect them?
Well, it protects them from being sued, but it's not clear that it protects them from criminal charges. Typically, some type of grant of immunity would not be done in a statute, but instead would be approved by the attorney general and entered by a court. So while they do have the civil side immunity, it's not clear that they have the criminal immunity, although certainly that's something their attorneys are going to raise.
So that's certainly going to be an interesting test of the emergency manager law as the attorney general goes forward with this case.
Oh, absolutely. And you're going to have challenges to the charges, any number of them, because there are a lot of different legal arguments here, whether they have the type of office that falls within the misconduct in office crime. And then you have this very interesting new charge that we've seen here, the false pretenses charge, one that hasn't been used against any of the other defendants related to the water crisis.
Yeah, what does that mean legally when we say false pretenses? What does it mean?
Well, the crime of false pretenses, traditionally, one of the theft offenses, like larceny or embezzlement, false pretenses is when you lie to someone to get them to transfer property to you. So if I lie to you about how much I'll pay you or the validity of a check, and you give me the title to your car, that's false pretenses. So usually it's theft. Here, though, and the statute is broad, here the claim is they lied to get the bonds issued and that was used to obtain money from the bond purchasers. This is not the typical way that the statute is used, but it is a very broad provision. So their conduct might fit in under it, but I certainly expect to be an immediate challenge that this has nothing to do with theft by the defendants.
Howard Croft and Dorothy Johnson also charged with conspiracy and false pretenses. Again, both 20-year felonies. They were heading the public works and utilities departments when this lead contamination happened. Why do you think they're facing the same charges as the two EMs? Because weren't they just following orders?
Yes and no. I think to a degree they were. They were told to get this done, but the devil is in the details. And it was how they were trying to get the new KWA, the new Water Authority, plant up and running. And to get the money for it, they played fast and loose. And indeed, all four defendants are accused of playing fast and loose with the reason for the bond issuance and how the money was going to be used. And that's the basis for this charge, that essentially they lied. Typically, in these types of cases, you find a lie and then build your case out from there.
Read the tea leaves for us, if you can, Peter, as you look over the charges now filed against 13 people. Is there a pattern that you can pick out and discern?
These are not going to be easy cases. The pattern here is what the Attorney General and Todd Flood, the special prosecutor, have focused on is trying to show misstatements or lies even by these different defendants and to paint a picture of them as not just playing near the edge by overlooking or not acting properly and getting the water for Flint, but actually taking steps, active steps, toward misleading others who might have been able to prevent this. So this is a case that is built around misinformation by these defendants and even outright lies by the defendants to try to show that they're bad people. And of course, that's what every prosecution is, to show that the defendant is a bad person. That's going to be, I think, their path to try to do this.
As a former prosecutor, are you feeling things kind of lining up, or is this a path that you could have seen yourself following as a former prosecutor?
There aren't a lot of paths to try to go after officials like this who did not enrich themselves. That's always what you look for, and that has real jury appeal, when someone acts in a way to benefit themselves. We don't have any indications of that. So this is really a case about not acting properly with the authority they have. And so you have statutes here or crimes, misconduct in office, willful neglect, false pretenses in this case. They're trying to stretch them to cover what happened. It was always an issue here of, could the Attorney General find real criminal conduct? In other words, something that's going to strike a juror as, hey, this isn't just bad management, but this is criminal conduct. I still don't know whether they're over that threshold yet.
Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning. As always, Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does.
Denzel Washington has been acting for more than 40 years, playing almost everything. Shakespeare, gangsters, action heroes. Now at 61, in what he calls his fourth quarter, Denzel Washington has decided to focus on a project that's more important to him than any work he's done. bringing to the screen the works of one of America's greatest playwrights, the late August Wilson, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. Wilson, who died in 2005, wrote 10 iconic plays known as the American Century Cycle, which explore the Black American experience in each decade of the 20th century. Denzel has committed to producing all of them, 9 for HBO. But Fences, Wilson's most popular work, opens in movie theaters this Christmas. Denzel directs as well as stars.
Troy, you ought to stop that line.
Fences is set in Pittsburgh in the 1950s and 60s, when racial integration was just gaining a toehold.
He ain't said nothing. He told me to go down to the commissioner's office next Friday. Whoa!
Washington plays 53-year-old Troy Maxson, whose life is defined by his big personality and his bigger disappointments.
Fire me because I asked a question? That's all I did.
He is a garbage man who had great ability to play baseball, but he came along at a time blacks weren't accepted yet in the big leagues. So he was frustrated by that.
Anybody can drive a truck. How come you got all the whites driving and the colored lifted?
Washington filmed Fences in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, a once vibrant black neighborhood where August Wilson grew up. The people who went to work and to church and raised their families here inspired many of his plays. Fences is the story of a family unraveling. Troy from his wife Rose and from his son Corey.
Look, boy, the white man ain't gonna let you get nowhere with no football, no way. Now, you get your book learning so you can work your way up at the A&P and learn how to fix cars or build houses. Get you a trade. This way you got something can't nobody take away from you.
Do you see your father in Troy?
In some regards, he couldn't read. Well, he had the same conversation with me about getting a good trade. You know, he worked for the water department in New York, and he could get me on at the water department. And he said, you know, I could be a supervisor in 25 years. He's like, you get a good job, you get a trade.
Secure job.
Yeah, a secure job, exactly. And like Rose, my mother could see further, you know. No, he's got to get an education. He's got to go to college. And, you know, he couldn't see that far.
Times have changed, Troy. People change. The world changing, and you can't even see it.
You hear often that black actors, black movies don't play well overseas. Is that the truth, or is that an excuse?
I've heard everything. And what I hear keeps changing. Because they used to say it didn't sell over here. Then it does. Then they say it doesn't sell in the South. Then it does. Well, it doesn't sell in Europe. Then it does. So I just keep pushing. Well, what an opportunity I have to prove them wrong.
And he has. Becoming one of Hollywood's most bankable stars, he's favored to get a 7th Oscar nomination for Fences.
This is all happening at a time when the Oscars are being criticized for lack of diversity. I'm just wondering, what do you think about that?
I don't have to think about it. I've lived it. I've been the guy at the Oscars without my name being called. I've been the guy at the Oscars when my name is called. I've been the guy at the Oscars when everybody thought they was going to call my name and they didn't. So I've lived it.
So what would you say to the people who are looking at this process and saying it's unfair?
Yeah, and so what? You gonna give up? If you're looking for an excuse, you'll find one.
In race.
You can find it wherever you like. You can't live like that. Just do the best you can do. So much for integration. Don't know what I was thinking. I'm moving back to Southside. So much for integration. Don't know what I was thinking. I'm moving back to Southside.
Michelle Obama was recently interviewed by CBS, and she drew attention to a number of really interesting topics, including the notion that she's a so-called angry black woman. Now, that was a common criticism during Obama's administration, and she never really understood why she was called an angry black woman. I don't understand why she was called an angry black woman, because I literally never saw her angry once. But nonetheless, she did respond to that criticism during the interview. Take a look at what she had to say.
When you were labeled that angry black woman, was that one of the things that knocked you back?
Well, that was one of those things that you just sort of think, dang, you don't even know me.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you just sort of feel like, wow, well, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
You know? And that's the first blowback, because you think, wow, that is so not me. But then you sort of think, well, this isn't about me. This is about the person or the people who write it.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just the truth.
That's what Maya always used to say.
Yeah, it's
to me.
Just so yes. It's so much about that. And then you start thinking, oh, wow, We're so afraid of each other. You know, color, wealth, these things that don't matter still play too much of a role in how we see one another. And it's sad. Because the thing that least defines us as people is the color of our skin. It's the size of our bank account. None of that matters. You know this.
Yes, of course.
You know, it's our values. It's, you know, it's how we live our lives.
I kind of wish that she didn't talk about wealth in that answer.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense.
It didn't make sense. And also, I feel like the size of your bank account, in some cases, does say something about who you are.
Yeah.
Right?
Look, I don't begrudge rich people. And Oprah, she just worked in entertainment, got rich. To the best of my knowledge, is not a person who's trying to get, you know, do somehow capture the government and do corruption and all that stuff. Bless her heart, right? Bill Gates, you know, and some people get mad at the Microsoft, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, he's an entrepreneur. My point is, don't get mad at your local dentist for having, you know, a nice house. That's fine. But at the same time, like, one, it's weird. It doesn't fit in with the race question at all. And sometimes some wealthy people do make it matter.
Like the Walton family that own Walmart, you know.
Do you know that 6 members of the Walton family have as much money as the bottom 50% of Americans? And it's easier, and they're both now rich, Michelle Obama and Oprah. So I really wish they hadn't brought that up because, like, as they're sitting in a gorgeous, whatever that is, like, is that in the White House? I don't know. But wherever it is, it's gorgeous, and they're both incredibly rich, telling a lot of us who are not that rich, like, oh, wealth doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to you because you already have it.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to race. I mean, you know where it comes from. It's an old racial stereotype about how black people are angry. And it's, again, it comes all the way back to the days of slavery. So it's like it's not to dredge up slavery. Again, it's just to tell you where that stereotype comes from, right?
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason that people did that in the South was, one, if you were a slave and you weren't angry, that's kind of weird, don't you think? If I was a slave, I'd be super pissed. And after the Civil War and I'm finally free, you have all the right in the world to be angry. But they weren't, you know, and I'm not saying that they weren't angry overall and they were, everybody was angels and yada, yada. I'm just saying that it was a made-up stereotype and it was mainly projection. After the grotesque violence done on African-Americans in this country, they then turned around and called them violent and angry and it was done to suppress them.
Now, I completely understand that... angry is used in a very negative, disparaging way in the context of race. And what I'm about to say is a little different, but I think that this point still matters. I think it's interesting that the word angry has a negative connotation to it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's especially negative if it's associated with women. And so you don't hear angry black man as often as you hear angry black woman because it has a little more of a negative impact if it's in regard to a woman. Mm-hmm. And so look, the point that I want to make is anger is not something that someone should be ashamed of or someone should try to hide or someone should try to, you know, somehow downplay. Anger is a real human emotion that oftentimes comes from a place where you feel like something unfair happened or there's some sort of injustice. And it's what makes us human, right?
So, Anna, you bring up a great point. So, look, on the issue of gender, it's a little mixed. Certainly they hit Obama with angry black men as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stereotype that's existed for a long time as well. Do they use it more against women? I don't know. It's a fair question, and I see why you say that might be the case. But I think the great point is that part of the reason that they do the stereotype is that so they don't want that reaction. Hey,
yes.
You better not be an angry black man. You better not be an angry black woman, right? Because hey, just leave the powerful alone. Whatever the current status quo is, it wants to protect itself. And it has trouble protecting itself if everybody's angry.
Yes.
So what it tells you is, everybody calm down, be cool. Be cool, everything's fine. What are you all so angry about?
I think in a lot of cases, anger shows that you're aware.
For Dylan Roof, life. For Dylan Roof, the next few days and weeks of his young life will prove his most memorable. That's saying something, considering his slaughter of 9 souls in a black church in Charleston. For in the next few days and weeks, a jury will convene to decide whether he gets a death sentence or life. As someone who lived a lifetime on death row, my opposition is unequivocal. Even in a case such as this, my opposition to the state taking life doesn't falter. Even in this case of a witless white supremacist, a killer of 9 black Christian souls, if I know anything, I know death row. I've seen it drive men stark, raving mad. That said, my one opinion carries no real weight in this case, for unless I miss my guess, no juror will ever hear these words. They will decide his fate after he delivers his own closing arguments, which will hardly endear him to his jurors. A death verdict for Roof strengthens the repressive powers of the state and gives it the false aura of justice. If a death sentence fails, it helps slow the inherent injustice of the death penalty. It will help all of the men and women on death row. My decision to oppose death for Roof wasn't an easy one, but I believe it's the right one. No matter his beliefs, decades on death row, as with decades in solitary, are mind-frying experiences. Nothing he has experienced in his brief life can prepare him for such outcomes. For life in prison ain't no picnic. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 24th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you would like to share your views. The number, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. If you have thoughts on any of the audio segments that we heard, anything else that took place over the last 7 days, or just your views on racism, white supremacy that you would like to share, dial in. Looking forward to the exchange. We will be here tomorrow. That would be December 25th. Dr. Niana Rasayan will be hanging out with us. We will review some of the major events from 2016. We'll review some of the legendary victims of racism, black people who transitioned this year. We'll get some of Dr. Rasayan's reflections on the end of the Obama tenure in the White House and other matters related to racism, white supremacy. He'll be with us normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Same thing I said yesterday. If folks are doing the holidays and participating in the madness, if you want to dial in and share, I know we have broadcasted during a number of holidays over the years, and at times victims have had some interesting experiences go down in the midst of all that. So if you want to share, if you have some constructive exchanges with relatives during the madness, you can chime in, let us know how things are going down tomorrow. But we will be here. We'll also be here on Tuesday and Wednesday of the upcoming week. We will have one more white person in the building before the end of the 2016 calendar year. Dr. Glenda Gilmore will discuss her book on gender and Jim Crow. She analyzed the history of white supremacy in the state of North Carolina and showing white women's participation in that system. She'll be with us on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we'll hit everybody's favorite area of people activity, Area 8. We'll have two non-white guests on the program who both have a white mother and a non-white father. So we'll review some of the patterns in their experience growing up, how their white mother practiced white supremacy. With that, a few things before we get to the callers. First up, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. The blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge, sincere thanks to all the folks who have supported us nearly 8 years, 8 year anniversary coming up in just a couple months. Hope during that time we have helped folks get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and some strategies to help us eliminate this problem immediately. Few quick notes that I wanted to make sure I got in. Generally, it's been my experience that the news slows down a little bit towards the end of the year. You have a lot of outlets. They take holidays. They, you know, won't be doing any new content. Some people won't be doing any new content, new reporting until the beginning of next year. They just kind of blow off the whole rest of December. That's been the case a lot of times. That did not happen this year. I generally count the number of audio clips that I, you know, include for our compensatory call-in. Generally, that number is somewhere around 12. For this week, that number was closer to 17. And I still had, even with that, and I mean, that's really high. That's significantly more audio segments that we normally have on the compensatory call-in. And I still left out significant things. If folks remember the case in Dietrich, Idaho, this was from the spring of 2016 when this became big news. John R.K. Howard, this is a white male student in Dietrich, Idaho. He's in high school, but he is over 18. That's why they released his name. But he, some of his other race soldier classmates, and it was even alleged that some of the white faculty at this high school, that they bullied, terrorized, called all kinds of racist names this disabled black teenage student at the school. He was one of the only black people in this little rural Idaho town. They raped him. They put a wire hanger in his rectum and kicked it. Just went on and on and on and on and on. All of these acts of terrorism and sexual terrorism directed at this black student, Mr. Howard, he was able to plead to a lesser charge this week. The prosecutor said that they had no evidence that this was a sex crime. That's what he said in court. Again, inserted a hanger in his rectum, kicked it. I think they had said in a previous report they gave him a wedgie so bad that it ripped his undergarments. They gave him a wedgie so bad. They had all of this activity that had been going on for years and years and years, humping him and calling him Kool-Aid and all these other racist names. He gets to plead to a lesser charge, no sex crime, doesn't have to register as a sex offender, and spends no time in jail. That was one, didn't even include that. Also, if folks recall, there was an event that happened. This was right before the election. It was a black church, predominantly black church in Mississippi. It was set on fire. They wrote Vote Trump on the side of the church. Folks recall, we played the news segment about this on the compensatory call-in. And I think some people said that it sounded suspicious. It did not sound like the type of thing that folks believed. It just seemed like someone might have been doing this to mislead people or to trick people or something. It just seemed really odd. Well, this week, They arrested a black male who is actually a member of the church. I believe his name is Henry McClinton. He was charged with setting this fire and writing "Vote Trump" on the church. They said the church is a total loss. It's going to be have to be torn down and rebuilt. Stood out for many reasons. It'll be interesting to see how all of this, you know, goes through at the trial, the evidence that's presented. What it also reminded me of was that in 2012, right in the same time period, right around the time of the election, if people remember, and I think this was also in Mississippi, Sharmika Moffitt, if people remember the name, this was a black female. She reported that she had been attacked by some white guy, that he wrote KKK on her vehicle and then threw gasoline on her and set her on fire. She had to go to the hospital. She had really bad burns and everything. And then the police reported that she had fabricated this report, that she set her own self on fire, and that she did the she was the one who wrote KKK on the, her own vehicle. And then they eventually charged her with making a false report and all of this. But if people remember, this happened at the exact same time back in the autumn of 2012, right in the midst of election season. Same thing. And I think it was also in Mississippi, but that's what it reminded me of. Just something to think about. If folks saw that, have any thoughts on that, it'd be good to hear your thoughts on that as well. Before we get to the callers, just remind folks, if you could take about 5 minutes for whatever you need to share, that would be great. I will keep my eye on the time just to make sure everybody gets an opportunity to share their views. And then once everybody gets their single opportunity, then we can go around and get people if they have multiple things they would like to share. Again, strictly for the compensatory call-in, if we could not use metaphors. Again, it's been my experience, my conclusion. A lot of times when people talk about racism, we employ analogies, metaphors, we make comparisons between things that are not equivalent. And that is a huge problem with regards to getting an accurate understanding of what racism is and how it works. I think white people, they're doing this deliberately, where they will compare white supremacy racism to things that they know are not equivalent. They will use these metaphors just so that we cannot get a correct grasp of thinking of this problem. It's just another way of practicing deception. Non-white people, myself included, I just think we have been subjected to racist, number one, being deceptive in the way that they talk about racism, not being accurate, not being direct, pussyfooting. And then also just in our confusion about what racism is and trying to articulate our views. Sometimes I think we just employ metaphors in the hopes that will reflect our thoughts, what it is that we're trying to say, either about counter-racism or racism or whatever it is. And a lot of times those metaphors, analogies, they do not accurately reflect our thoughts. They do not even make a clear representation. Frequently they're not even accurate. We could just be explicit, direct, exactly what it is that we're trying to say. That would be great, and that's just the request that I make for the compensatory call in. With that, the number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. With that, we will nab the first few people who dialed in with a hand up. I'll just go down and get hands as I see them. And quickly, the anniversary of Michael Griffith's death, the black male who was chased by a gang of hoodlums in the great state of New York. When I heard Al Sharpton in that segment, I almost went back. There was a different radio segment from about 2 years ago on New York Public Radio where they were talking about some of Al Sharpton's activities, and they spoke with some white people. This is where Al Sharpton was stabbed in New York, where he was there marching nonviolent peaceful protest about a different victim of racism. And he was stabbed nearly fatal. He survived, obviously, and is still rolling. But they went back and they were talking about this event, and they talked to some white people, white women, no less. And this white woman on the radio, she said, I can't stand Al Sharpton. I hate him. And blah, blah, blah. And she just went on this tirade. And the guy doing the interview, he said, well, he was stabbed right here. He was almost killed. And she said, good. I wish he had died. she wished death on Al Sharpton. And I was using that as a sound clip for a while. I almost went back and inserted it in that clip since his voice was there. But it just comes to mind whenever his voice comes up. You don't have to agree with everything he says, everything that I say. But under the system of racism, white supremacy, there is much work to do, and regardless of all that, you'll probably still have white people sitting around. Even if you are the biggest coon Uncle Tom in the universe, you'll probably still have white people sitting around and wishing death and misery on you. That is the system of white supremacy, and more importantly, that is what it means to be white. Right on. Peace out to Al Sharpton. Folks who dialed in, first set of folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to everyone. I am going to go fast. Starting off, I was invited to a football clinic in Orlando, the same place where the championships are played. It's something that's annual. It's pretty big, and normally those type of things are offered to the teams that win championships. I both refuse to attend it, let alone talking about going there to speak at the clinic. Primarily due to the coaching profession and how black males are mistreated within that particular job. Number two, there was an incident, and I like when you make the reports on these kind of like everyday incidents that take place. For instance, there's one that was down here at a local high school, one of the rivals that we play, where on a long, consistent basis, the predominantly white population at the high school bullies, terrorizes, picks on the area of black children that go to this high school from a area that's called Parang. And they isolated on this one black male student who, and this is something that is a good story. He actually, you know, these days on how the children actually film the fights, and it resulted into a fight in the classroom. And he actually picked the white male up and body slammed him in the middle of the class. Now, mind you, somehow it was determined that it was an act of self-defense. They interviewed the mother. The mother said, I don't condone my son fighting, but in this particular case, it was an act of self-defense, and I'm all with him, behind him, and support him in what he did on it. And actually, when it came down to it, the black student, the black male student, did not get into any trouble. Kind of like, you know, if anybody get the time to want to comment on the mixing incident that took place that went viral with the advent of this white female slapping him and punching him in the face before he retaliated. I agree with Mr. Fuller's rule about striking a female. I'm assuming he's talking about black females or non-white females, because in this particular case, in my opinion, I'll just say on the surface, all bets are off when it comes to a white female. My My best solution is to stay out of contact with white females, period. And more likely you would avoid what he had to go through. The last but not least, the interview that was talked about on that particular, I forgot that station that the interview was done with, but I know it's something that you normally have on a lot of times, was quite disturbing because they tried to equalize Mrs. Obama and Ms. Winfrey with white people by mentioning about how wealthy they are. And it's a very slick thing that white people do in order to confuse the issue of racism. Mrs. Winfrey and Mrs. Obama do not have ownership of anything that white people need or non-white people. And their wealth can be taken away from them and they can be destroyed within minutes. I.e. Orenthal James Simpson and upcoming William Cosby. And that's all I have to say right now. And thank you for listening.
Before I nab some of the other folks that dialed in, I did just want to say in that clip, Michelle Obama actually was the person that brought up class or wealth, and that was from the Young Turks. They played the clip, so okay. You could hear Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey speaking, and then it was actually Sink who said, you had to listen closely, but he said it was kind of confusing her bringing up wealth because that doesn't really have anything to do with racism, which is the same thing that I was saying, although I thought that it could have been, you know, white people always most to blame, in my opinion, so they could have, you know, set the parameters for what was going to be discussed, or even if they're not directly present, a lot of times we know how we had better speak about things if we don't want to get on white people's bad side. So I had that thought as well, but he did. I think Sink had your opinion. Wealth is not equivalent to racism. He said something pretty close to that, surprisingly.
Well, in that case with Mrs. Obama, she said what she said. All non-white people are entitled to their opinion about racism, but with me, I would say that everything that she has or Ms. Winfrey has, it can be taken away from them within seconds.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, to the callers and the listeners. This is a female caller from New York. And I did not hear any of the clips. I was on the plantation. But I thought to call in to share a couple of field notes with you. The first is, I guess both of them are in the area of racist suspects' treatment of me. One of them I would call civil, and the other one I would label as getting what I asked for in the context of the code book stating that if there's anything that victims of racism need, they should definitely ask white people for it. The first incident I would like to talk about is I'm taking care of my mother. I think a cop said to on the program, I think last night or a couple of times, and I had to run out to the library, which is about a 2-minute drive from my home, and it was at nighttime. And I left the house, and my mom, I guess, you know, sometimes she gets she's a little nervous, you know, nervous type. So she decided that she was going to take it upon herself to activate the alarm system. And I was at the library sitting on the computer, and I didn't have my cell phone on me because I had left that in another location that day. And as I was on the computer, I looked, and these messages began to pop up from the alarm system company letting me know that the alarm had gone off. And I thought that was weird. I didn't set it. And I saw that someone was trying to call my phone, which was probably the alarm system company and what have you. Anyway, I rushed back home to find the police officer in front of my home. And it looked as if he had just knocked on the door or something. And I rushed out of the car, and I was petrified. I'm not going to lie. And he said to me, I just started explaining. I said, my mom is in there, and I'm sure she touched something or did something that she wasn't supposed to do. And she set the alarm, and she probably tripped it while setting it herself. And this is my residence and everything. And he looked at me, and he said, this is a white person, a white police officer. Racist suspect, race soldier. And he said to me, it's okay. These are his exact words. It's okay. I am here for you. Is there anything else that I can do for you today? And I looked at him. I just kind of was like, that was not what I was expecting. I had never heard any, I've had several run-ins with police officers in New York. And I had never heard one of them utter those words. I was very surprised. And I kind of stood there for a second. He kind of looked at me as if, why is she not answering me? So I just said, no, thank you very much, officer. I appreciate it. I ran back in the house. And of course, my mother was hysterical and everything, but everything worked out well. The second incident I would like to speak about is, I think it was in September, Gus had a guest on his program, Natasha Marin, reparations.me, I think it's the name of the website. And I, you know, questioned her because I didn't think she was serious about the way she was presenting this. You know, as much as blood has been shed, you know, all over the world, constantly, forever, since the beginning of time, and all the other atrocities. But anyway, I said, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot. Because I checked out the website, and I saw that there were people who asked for stuff that got stuff. So I decided, I said, okay, let me sit down and think about something that I need, that I think white people would give me. And I didn't think about any money or anything like that. I thought about airline miles because my son was still in college in New York. And, you know, I'm using most of my pennies that I've saved up for, you know, my expenses, my mother's medical care. And I recently just got a little plantation job. So, you know, I was kind of stressed for cash to get my son home. So thanks for the holiday, for the Thanksgiving holiday. I asked for both holidays. But, you know, I laid out a story, and I said, let me throw this out there and see who will respond. Well, one Becky responded, and she asked me if I had a GoFundMe page, and I said no. Never heard from her again. Then the other one asked me if I had something called a Venmo account, because she really wants to help. I said, okay, well, I made a Venmo account. See how much money she would put in it. And she put $75 in. I said, okay, thank you. And I said, I'll hold on to that because she's going to need cab fare to get to the airport, what have you. Okay, so I got an email from this one. Well, let me backtrack. From a white person who read my post on reparations.me and said that she had airline miles to donate. And I said, okay, thank you very much. And she said she understood my, you know, she was in a similar situation where she had parents to care for, blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay. And I said, well, what's the best way to do this? She said, I think I need to, you know, we probably need to speak to make the arrangements. Okay, so, you know, I had questions. You know, outside of getting the airline miles, I wanted to know, you know, how she heard about the site, what made her go on the site, has she been contributing to the site, has it made an impact in her life as well as the people who she has donated to life. You know, I had questions. Anyway, let me just backtrack and say I didn't know it was a woman at first. I'm just saying it was a white person because it was one of those names that could be a man's name or a woman's name. So when I saw the name, I immediately got frightened because I thought it was a man, a white man. And I had a whole nother ball game after that. When I saw that name, I said, I don't care about nothing because I just thought about, you know, cowbell, cowbell. This might be an attempt, you know, because I identified myself as a female. So I said, well, let me just ask questions. Let me just get, you know, get what I get and just say thank you and, you know, and bounce. But anyway, when I got the telephone number, I called and it was a woman. I said, okay. A woman from Texas explained that she had 5 daughters in school at one time. 5 college tuitions. 5. All right. Long dollars. So I said, okay, you know. And she was getting the information, so we got the airline miles together and the ticket. And I said, after I get the ticket information and everything solidified, I'm going to ask a question. So I said, yeah, so, what, you know, how did you hear about the site? Oh, I just go on there every now and then, you know, and, you know, I just try to do what I can because some of these people, you know, some of the people there, I just, you know, I can't do anything from where I am. I mean, I can't get anybody groceries. I can't help somebody with their laundry or with their children. So I just go on there every now and then and I try to see what I can do. And I said, oh, okay. You know, then I asked another question. I said, is this something that you do regularly? And she diverted back to the ticket, didn't want to talk about it. I said, okay, let me try something else. Where are you from? I said, where are you? And then she told me she was in Texas. And then she goes on, the government here is terrible. The government here is just absolutely awful. And I thought to myself, the government, right? The government is racist, okay? So this could be an impact on her decision to patronize requests on the site. And then I asked, have you done this before? And again, she diverted back to the ticket. And I thought about Dr. Wilson. White people don't want to talk about racism. I immediately thought about it. So I said, you know what? Forget it. Let it go. That was what I needed. It was a round trip ticket, okay? I think she got long dollars because one of the flights, connecting flights on the way back, got canceled. And he was put up in with a hotel, transportation, meal, couches, the whole nine. I was like, you know, not, you know, sleeping on the floor waiting till the next night. No. They hooked him up with the whole nine. So then I looked up her name online. She got long dollars. She is in the area of science and technology. And she is in the area of robotics. I mean, doing symposiums and all of that. So anyway, that's my experience with reparations.me. I got something out of white people that I could use. And I encourage anybody to look at it, look at the site, think about something practical. Everybody wants money, but, you know, if you really get creative with it, you might get, you know, you might get a quote unquote well-meaning white person to fulfill your request. And that's all I had. Oh, one more thing. Gus, I'm working on, you know, getting my little nickels together, and I will compensate you. I believe in that because, you know, I don't, without the cows, this would not have been possible. And I am mindful of that. And that's all I had to say. I'll mute my line. Thank you for listening.
Well, I'll be jiggered, a good white person. How about that? I did say way back when Natasha Merrin, when she was on the program, I encouraged folks to go on the website and make a request. And I, same thing that you just heard from the female caller in Brooklyn, not necessarily money. I said, same thing that she said. You can think of some questions that you want to ask, or if there is a tangible need that, you know, a white person could probably easily knock out, make a request, let us know what happens. Even if you don't get it, fine, you can report back. You can make an experiment out of it, because she said they were racists were terrorizing people on the site, too. So I said that would be great, too. If you get terrorized, they just come on and call you a nigger a bunch of times and that sort of thing. Great, you can let us know that. But I didn't hear from anybody else. I was glad she followed up, because she had emailed me and told me that, you know, she made a request and the whole nine. So I was I'm so glad we got the update. But yeah, reparations.me, Natasha Merrin, she was with us October. You should still have time. She did say she was going to shut the site down at least by the end of the year. And I think she had said she was even thinking about doing it sooner, because she had got so much racist backlash from people terrorizing and threatening her and other black people who made requests on the site. So I don't think it's, or at least I'm under the impression it's not going to be up indefinitely. So if you want to make a request, get to it and let us know how it turns out. Other folks we have not heard from at all, thank you so much for sharing what happened. I'm so glad you were able to get your child to come visit for free, and great lodging to boot.
How about that? Thank you.
For sure, for sure. And again, white people can knock that out easy. That's what I mean. They have these type of resources just stacked up. A lot of our problems could be knocked out in like 5 seconds. Easy, 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 easy. When Mr. Fuller, I'm so reminded some of the just little things that he says that are so profound, that things are like this because this is how white people like it. That's why the world is the way it is. Not all these little problems. People sit around and whine and cry. And, oh, man, if we could do that. A whole lot of this stuff could be taken care of in 5 minutes if white people wanted to do so. They do not, and further, they like it the way it is with black people suffering. Anybody we haven't heard from, call us we haven't heard from, should be with us.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, I got a little food in my mouth. I was just listening to Mamiya Abdul-Jabbar, and you know, he is a victim of racism. You know, his opinion. He has a right to an opinion. But I wonder to his allies who are white, kind of, could they be also agreeing with the same thing? And could that affect his opinion? But I don't know. I'm not saying whether it is or whether it's not, but, you know, just the simple fact that people don't think Dylan Roof deserves to die, even that it's questioned, does Dylan Roof deserve to die? You know, I don't think Osama bin Laden, I don't think it was ever a question, did he deserve to die now? I don't think, but, you know, it was just automatically assumed Bin Laden deserved death. But the fact that we even questioned it, you know, in my opinion, shows the lack of importance of the lives of victims of racism. But that's just my personal opinion, and I mute my line and I continue to listen and learn. Thank you.
Fascinating. I did just one quick thing before we get other folks we haven't heard from. After I heard his commentary, I think Mumia Abdul-Jabbar, I think because he was on death row for a long time, I think almost 20 years, if not longer, he was on death row for such a long time, and for such a long period of time, he has been staunchly opposed to the death penalty. For all the reasons that he, or for those, everything that he said in that clip and beyond, where he's talked about it eloquently, brilliantly, logically, and connecting it to racism, white supremacy, because, you know, black people disproportionately get the death penalty, too, as we heard in the sound clip today. But I think it is just, this is these are my beliefs. This is my principle. I'm against the death penalty. And so I'm going to be consistent in that belief. I think that might be what he was doing or why he came to that conclusion with Dylann Roof. It also could be influenced by the racists that are around him. I think it's white people that are responsible for him being able to make some of these recordings and what have you and having his voice out to the public at all. So that could be, but I also think at least to some degree he's just being sincere to his principles, his beliefs, and he's been publicly staunchly opposed to the death penalty for a long time for obvious reasons. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, the line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers and the listeners. Great show. I love the clips. Great, insightful commentary by everyone. And, of course, VGQ to Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I totally understand his logic as to why, and after his life experience, why he is against the death penalty. But for me, anybody white who gets the death penalty, I have no problem with it whatsoever. They're at war with us. They are the enemy. So if there's anything that sends them home a little early so that they can, one less person can terrorize a black person, I am all for it all day, every day. I agree with the firefighter in Florida. The white female gets no quarter. That's how I function every day. They get no quarter whatsoever. And thank goodness none of them have ever tried me. And I, just from my life experience, I agree with Dr. Wilson's assessment that white people truly know who to try when they do the racist things that they do, that they really have an innate sense as to who they can victimize easily, and they tend to avoid those that they can't as far as non-white people that they encounter. That's been my experience quite a bit throughout my life. I haven't had many encounters with white people, thank goodness, attempting to really, I would say, assault me in a physical manner or whatever the case may be. I'd say from my experience, I agree with Dr. Welsing on that. I found it interesting, the clip you played with the so-called mixed race female who ended up marrying a white male. And in the clip, at one point she said that she was glad that he was not black so that she didn't have to worry about him coming home at night. And then and before she said that, she said she wished that he was black so that he could better relate to her struggles. And to me, that those two sentences really speak to the massive amounts of confusion that can develop in the minds of so-called mixed race children, especially when they choose to involve themselves in tragic arrangements. And it also speaks to her deep understanding of the system of white supremacy in regards to how black people are treated with that statement as well, in reference to, and juxtapose that to how white people are treated in the system of white supremacy. So I find that to be a very poignant clip. The clip about the black female that was arrested for defending her son, who was assaulted by a white male, just speaks to Neely Fuller's assessment that black people don't qualify to be parents in a system of white supremacy because we have no control over their daily reality. And of course, when we do make moves to try and defend our children, a lot of the times we end up getting in trouble just for even attempting to thwart the machinations of white supremacists in the system. Again, Neely Fuller Jr., brilliant counter-racist. I would say he's just incredible. So I'm thankful for him and the work that he's done. Also, the clip on the story of Michael Griffiths, very interesting. I was a young person at the time that he was killed. And I've always told people that, actually not too long ago, I had a recent conversation with another black person and explained to them, they were discussing racism in New York. And I said, well, ultimately, there's sundown towns in New York City, and Howard Beach is one of those places. Bensonhurst is another one, and there's quite a few others. But the racism in New York is no different than any place else in the system of white supremacy. It's intense, and you need to be careful of where you are. And sadly, that was a story that stood out quite a bit, just like Willie Turks and Yusuf Hawkins, which were two other incidents that were famous at that time. I wanted to just give a shout out to the black female who used the site, the Reparations ME site. I thought that that was just awesome. Her questions for the person that ended up donating the travel miles for her son to be able to come home. I'm happy for you that you were able to see him during this holiday season. Hopefully you get to have an enriched experience as far as connecting with your son and just bringing the family together during this time. And I hope all goes well for you and for all the other callers on the line. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. Appreciate that, Roz. Other folks that we have not heard from, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. This is 1842. I took a couple notes, and I was going to go over them before I started speaking, but to try to be more concise, so hopefully I'm able to get this out succinctly. The very first clip about the new set of genes leading to higher levels of stress and depression and high blood pressure, a lot of times that we are thinking about what traumatic experiences or discrimination or terrorism does just to the psyche, but that it has also, of course, long-lasting physical effects. I always think that that's really important somewhere. Someone, I don't know if that person was white or non-white, but posed the question of whether or not it was helpful. And they kind of stated that it wasn't. I think that it is helpful. I think the more that we understand how racism, white supremacy is affecting us mentally and physically, I think it makes us stronger to combat it. Just knowing that that's going to have an effect on me, on my body now, on my children, on my relationships, on my mental state, I think is very helpful. The more you know, I think the better. And I also think that, like, I just kind of wrote this down. It's just a postulation at the moment, but that it could potentially lead to a valid argument for reparations for all Black people, despite what lines we could trace. I mean, this is happening on a everyday basis to all of us, and we're all feeling it. Not to say that that's the way to go about it, but sometimes people just take the conversation about reparations off the table. Like, well, the people didn't get the 40 acres and a mule, so it's done, it's over, it's too hard now, we can't do it. And I maintain that we are still suffering, so I don't think the conversation should be off the table. The other clip, I can't remember exactly which one it was, but he was like, where he was told he was Native American and then realized that he wasn't. That was really sad, just because he was like, I'm just Black. And then it was just like, he sounded, I don't mean to laugh, but he sounded so sad. And I was like, I totally get it. Like, yes, it is. And not that it, bear with me, not that it sucks, but when it begins to sink in, I myself have been very confused, although I thought I knew what I thought I knew something, but every day it just sinks in more and more. I'm Black. Like, doesn't matter how smart I am, how outgoing, like, it does not matter. I'm Black. This is the world. And he might have not been thinking about it, but he was like, I'm just Black. Yes, it's terrible what that means when you, like, take it in. But anyway, Mr. Hinton's story about having been incarcerated for 30 years on death row, his story was really, really sad for me, especially when he talks about, like, how his mind escaped his body and his body acts as mine. Please make sure you come back. And his mind was like, will do. And the first place he goes is to sip tea with the queen. And what it made me think about was, like, to, you know, we cannot deny that a majority of us around the globe have a white God in our mind. You know, of all the places that you would go, you pick England, and I am in no way, shape, or form saying anything negatively about Mr. Hinton. I'm simply commenting on, you know, what he shared with us. So, like, VGQ, total victim, like, my heart goes out to him and the 30 years he spent there. I'm simply saying that what he was talking about really pinpointed that we do in mass have a white God that lives in our head, and like how he chose to do that. And, you know, he even voiced her you know, how like she like that just desire for a white people to be kind, to be nice, a white woman, you know, who knows, this could be like some Mary kind of, I don't know, but it was just, it was really interesting. And just like when we think about how much our lives are wasted, 30 years in solitary confinement, 30 years at a job that we hate, 30 years in like confusion, just so much of our time and our energy and our lives are just absolutely wasted in a system of racism and white supremacy. Do I have some time or have I reached my limit?
You have time.
Okay, I'll be quick. I'm kind of going through things. I'll just share that. Like I said, I didn't mean to laugh at him saying I'm just black, but for me these days on a daily basis, it's like, I'm black, like deep breath. And so it makes me a little impatient. Not that I'm not trying to be patient, but I'm just like frustrated, so to speak. And I hadn't really heard about the movie Fences, but I wasn't really excited. My mom kind of really wanted to see it. And when she read me the synopsis, I was like, so what? We're going to go watch a movie about a black man who couldn't fulfill his dreams, so he doesn't like his son and prevents his son fulfilling. Like, I was very unkind about this movie. I then went and watched a trailer, so I'm not so snappish. And, you know, I could see why my mother wanted to see it and so forth. But even Viola Davis, like, I felt so terrible about how Viola Davis is just being kind of, like, dragged around right now in Hollywood, in my opinion. But so I just wanted to say I have mixed feelings about it. If I watch it, I will make sure to take notes and report back on what I'm taking from it. With Miss Michelle Obama's segment, they said that angry was being connected to women. I disagree. I think angry is being more connected to being black. Like, they tried to play that gender thing, and I disagree. I don't think there's really a conversation where it's like angry women. I think it's angry black women, angry black men, just angry black people. So I think angry is more connected to being black than it is to a gender. They said, fair question. I just wrote that down. And then, but right at the end, anger shows that you are aware, which is so interesting because so many times that we are definitely don't want to be perceived as angry. I can speak for myself. Don't want to be, have not wanted to have been perceived as angry. However, my anger is definitely directly related to my level of awareness. Oblivion, they say, is bliss. But so it was like snuck right there at the end, but I thought it was a poignant little quote that I wanted to write down. And I do think, you know, as Solange says in her song, we got a lot to be mad about. So yeah, but I haven't actually watched the entire interview. I do intend to. But VGQ to Michelle, who knows, she could have slipped up and said that whole thing about money just out of nerves or something like that, you know, or not wanting, you know, race to just be the focus. But that is it for now. If there's time, I will come back around. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Other people that have commentary they would like to share, feel free. Did hear some metaphors off the table. Is metaphor, heard a few others through the course. Folks can be mindful of that. That would be spectacular proceeding. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele. I'm reporting from Rancho Cucamonga here in Southern California. It's beautiful this time of year. And I got to say, the first thing that's top of mind with this segment is the segment that we just heard with Michelle Obama. I think that collectively, throughout the media, there is a very strict, it might even be explicitly articulated, at, I guess, blacklisting on the word racist. It's just in these few years that they've been in office, hearing either one of the Obamas explicitly talk about racism is it's very rare. And when they're directly questioned about it over the years, it feels like, or it seems like, they've grown increasingly oblivious or not believable when they're talking about racism. I think the first, I think one of the incidences that made me first kind of pay attention to how unbelievable these people are sounding was the Flint water crisis, when Obama was used to demonstrate that the water apparently was safe to drink. That whole episode after that, it just became very clear to me that these people are deliberately saying things that don't make sense. They obviously don't make sense, and it's becoming very apparent to a lot of people. And if we're picking up on this, I have to say that I think white people have picked up on this, and I think that's one of the reasons why in these last few months of the Obama administration, they are going out of their way to talk about how gracious and how satisfied they are with the Obama administration. And that's something that...
Who's going out of their way to express this appreciation with the Obama administration? Who specifically?
I've just seen this, maybe it's, what is that, suspected white supremacists, suspected practitioners of racism. I've just seen that over the past few weeks, there's been an overabundance of praise and support for the Obama administration, and this is reflected in those polls that they call approval ratings. They keep on reporting that he has the highest approval ratings of any outgoing president or what have you, and it just, to me, it feels like they are very satisfied with the fact that they have not been able to substantively address the problem of white supremacy, and they know that this is something that has happened over the few years, and this is something that they're happy about. This is just something that I've picked up on. I don't know if it's true or not. I don't have any scientific verification for this, but this is just something that I'm picking up on. And another thing that I'm noticing throughout the media is that all of these incidences where suspected racists, I don't know if we're allowed to call them explicitly call them racist, even though that they're on camera saying racist things and making racist remarks and having racist outbursts. These people are having their identities obscured. Their identities, their names are not being published. For instance, the man who was shouting pro-Trump remarks and calling Hillary supporters B-words on a Delta flight, I don't believe his identity has been publicized in any meaningful way. He's always referred to as the man on the Delta flight. And then there was another incident with a racist, or with a suspected racist, and I believe it was a Target, and she was hurling racist remarks at a pair of so-called Latinos, and her identity, for the life of me, I'm not able to find the identity of these people. I think that it's becoming increasingly codified to not release the identities of the people who are being caught explicitly practicing racism in the media. And then finally, I just want to say that I've been asking some questions directly on my Facebook account. And one of the questions that I asked just directly that I think that all victims of racism should ask themselves and should ask other victims of racism and I think should just state publicly whenever they have the opportunity is, why do white people coddle cops who flagrantly violate the law? And if you just ask that in plain terms, don't let them, sidestep it. Don't let them talk around it. Just ask them that plain question to victims of racism. I think that a lot of confusion will be remedied. And I guess I'll mute my line at this point. Thank you so much.
Counting down the days to President Obama exiting the White House. I cannot wait. That is going to be party time. Do we have folks that we have not heard from at all? I hope people are not malingering and think you're going to wait till the last minute to dial in, because we have less than 50 minutes, so should be ample time. If you have not spoken, you think you want to share a word, feel free. Chime in. The number is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I did want to say quickly as well, the segment about being angry, being upset. If I had not played J. Cole's newest product, I would have been upset for not playing Solange right there, because that would have been a great intro. But I had already played that. Hadn't played J. Cole's new project yet. With regards to being angry, and I think the point that 1842 said at the end on the Young Turks, when they said being angry means that you are aware, and so that's why whites like to discourage, particularly black people, from being upset about racism. I thought that, too, was a very important point, and it even, I flashed back to yesterday, the book club, the breakthrough, Gwen Ifill's book. All of these breakthrough people, President Obama is the main figure in that book, U.S. Senator Cory Booker, even though he was not a senator at the time, he was the mayor of Newark, I believe, New Jersey. Artur Davis, I'm trying to think of some of the other people, main people that are in the book. Artur Davis, Harold Ford Jr., those are some of the main names that we've heard in the book right now. I don't think any of those people, like ever, sounds angry about racism and the way that black people are treated. I can't. If you called me right now and said, Gus T, we will give you $1 million or whatever you can think of, you can, you know, put whatever you can come up with in your head, we'll give it to you if you can think of a time when President Obama was really, or at least you concluded that President Obama was really upset about racism and the way black people are treated publicly. I don't think I could think of one. Not one. Not from the book. Not from the time he spent in the White House. Not from the time he was a senator. Not one. If you called me on it, Artur Davis, Michelle Obama, Cory Booker, I would lose that one. And I mean, I could rack my brain. I'll think until the end of, I think that might be a metaphor. I'll think about it till the end of the program. I think Gus would come up with an F on that one. I don't think those folks sound angry about racism, white supremacy. Any folks we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I've been wanting to mention something about this this animated movie. I think it's called Moana or something like that. And I noticed how I think they had The Rock voice one of the characters in that movie. And I found it interesting how they had his career going on this year, where it was one movie where it was a Welser moment in the trailer, where I guess he was in a movie with Kevin Hart, and they described it as sometimes you just need a little Hart and a big Johnson. So, you know, I thought about that, how they like to symbolically inject white supremacy in movies and whatnot, and just like how they I think made him, I guess, the sexiest man or something like that. But yet they put him in a movie like that where the character, if it's a non-white character, they won't really have the female have, I guess, a love interest that's like the white characters in, you know, in something like Frozen. So even in, you know, areas of entertainment where it's marketed to children, that's teaching them that you can't really be like the white people. So I thought that was interesting how that played out. And it was another segment in the audio segment where I think they was talking about the lady that was wearing the Muslim attire, I think the hijab. And I believe it was a white woman that said, can you tell me how race affects your life? And she says, don't talk about racism. I think that's what she said. You know, somebody can correct me. She said, tell me how race affects your life, but don't get into talking about racism. You know, I thought that was interesting, too, because I noticed how Neely Fuller, he talks about racism. And it seemed like that was a strategic act of racism and deception, trying to divorce the two words when they are pretty much synonymous. So that definitely seemed to try to pass off some confusion. And I noticed, like, with the word angry, like, that term angry white voters was used. And I heard one of my supervisors use it at the job. And it seemed like when it's applied to whites, it doesn't have that same connotation. They seem to glorify it then. But when it comes to the victims of racism, it's something that we are taught to have disdain for, and we should just try to get away from it. So, you know, I found that to be very interesting. And as the male caller pointed out about how the identities of white perpetrators are somewhere, I guess, redacted and hidden and not really revealed to people, I think that's very standard, pretty much, how they don't want to reveal the names. I think that's somewhat of a reward, you know, of those white people practicing racism, but they're trying to make it seem like they're punishing them. And I think it was another segment where there was, can't remember, how did it go? I can't think of it right now, but that's all I can think of to speak of, and I'll pass it on to the next person. And thank you very much.
For sure. I would not forgive myself since the point has been emphasized twice, racist being able to terrorize and violate people and then maintain anonymity. The enforcement officers in North Carolina that got drunk and then called the establishment owner a nigger had to be thrown out because at least one of the officers was intoxicated. They drunk and drove while under the influence, had to stop while driving to let one of the officers vomit out of the vehicle, had an accident, it seemed from the report, had an accident with another vehicle, got into a fight, and then the magistrate decided that there were no grounds for an arrest. After all of that, and as I stated repeatedly on my Facebook page, they didn't even mention, well, since these are enforcement officials, were they armed while all of this was going on? No mention of whether a service weapon was on anyone at the time. They, too, got to maintain anonymity. That is amazing. I think if you are a non-white person and you're over age of 18, doing any one of those things would have been grounds to have your mugshot plastered everywhere, television, newspaper, the whole nine. You could be a white person. Enforcement officers should be held to a higher standard. Do all of that, and they can't even come up with grounds to arrest you, much less identify who did all this. Only the system of white supremacy. Anybody that we have not heard from at all? And that case didn't even get any attention. I wanted to get that in as well. With all the attention focused on North Carolina and South Carolina, but all the attention with Keith Lamont Scott and HB2, and it hasn't been that long with Jonathan Farrell, Randall Carrick. That was just last year. All the attention, and you don't even, I haven't seen this blow up. I haven't seen this get tons of attention and people hashtagging, I can't believe this, and what's going to happen to them? Nothing. I had even struggled to find additional reports to get more information about this case. Now I can hush. Anyone we have not heard from? Oops. I'm sorry. Caller in Ohio, are you with us, ma'am? Not hearing you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We got you.
Okay. You got me now?
Loud and clear.
All right, then. Hello to you, Gus, the host, and to all the other callers and listeners on the line. You know, it just goes to show you just from the story you just told, you know, about these police officers and, you know, the times where we're at now. And, you know, I guess a couple of weeks ago, I was like saying about black people, you know, we don't have any rights. And yet, you know, and I mean, if we go back, say, like somebody said before the civil rights movement, you know, we saw this, things with the media, you know, covering white people, protecting white people, and then just, you know, always exposing black people. So this is where we're at now. The clip on the interracial lady, you know, that I guess according to, if I heard correctly, I guess she's whatever her coloring was, and she marries a white guy. And I, one thing I excuse me, that the lady that was doing the interview says they got married and then, you know, things begin to, I guess you begin, things begin to happen with in the marriage because now you're, you know, this race issue. And I'm sitting up here saying, but it seemed like to me you should have talked about that before you got married, you know. And then because she said something about she, you know, doesn't want to look like she's a child nanny. I think somebody made a point about she says one statement and then it seems like she says another statement. Something about she was glad what her husband wasn't black because she wouldn't have to worry about him, like, coming home at night. But then she wished he was black. And to me, it just, that's the confusion that, that, you know, these people have. In terms of President and Mrs. Obama, I, you know, I, and even like you said, Cory Booker, you know, Harold Ford, we know, you know, he's married to a white woman. They just had a baby. Actually, I saw that story on your page, you know, and he was in Tennessee and I think he ran for the Senate. I want to say, and I remember reading an article that they were basically saying he lost and that black women had a lot to do with that defeat because he was married to that white woman. But as you said, I don't hear any of them being upset about racism. And actually, it is, at least to me, the from them, the appearance that there is no such thing as racism. And every time when I hear that stuff, because, you know, white people say it, and, you know, when I hear, and, you know, white people will say, oh, it's black people making up stuff. So, you know, President Obama and Mrs. Obama, and, you know, for their 8 years, you know, it's pretty much, if you know, if you work hard and apply yourself, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I remember he said, I think it's a clip you play, he says, oh, we're better, we're better. And it's like, okay, yeah, really. And, you know, so I'm just not seeing that. In terms of the interview that the first lady had with Oprah, the clip that you played for the Turks, you know, and actually you, I'm quite sure we all on this line know that there are people today that's trying to convince people that it's not race, it's class. So henceforth, if you have money and everything, you're not going to have any problems. And so I, you know, I can only say, you know, well, you could ask Dr. Dre about that, seeing that some nondescript white man, what is it, 3-4 months ago, parks in front of his driveway. He's trying to get in the driveway, calls the police, and he's standing out in front of his house in handcuffs. You know, so, and Dr. Dre is worth, what, almost $500 million. So much for that. But I think the one thing, the statement she made the statement about, like you talking about the angry black woman. And so I do agree with somebody says, like you want to say, oh, angry women. It's like, no, it's never angry women. It's always angry black women. And that's always thrown up in our face, really to try, in my opinion, to trip us up. And I'm always kind of like the one that says, okay, so if I'm angry, so what? I'm angry. You know, I kind of feel if you have feelings and if you had compassion, and look around this world, you would be angry too. So for me, it's just like, okay, so what? I'm angry. Okay, and, you know, but with Mrs. Obama, she made the statement. She says, they don't even know me. And I just kind of thought that was a good response to that because, you know, they don't know. And so that's what they do. They throw that out in before us, excuse me, to try to trip us up, you know, and if we don't know how to handle it, we will be tripped up by that. You know, because my response is, so what? I'm angry. Okay, I'm angry. And, you know, but I just thought when she said that, that was a good thing. But one other statement she made on this interview with Oprah was after Trump was elected, and she made a statement to the fact that, well, this is what it feels like to have no hope. And I was on Facebook, and a lot of people were just like, especially the night of the interview, were agreeing with that statement. I'm just like, I disagree with that statement. You know, I haven't read or heard anywhere where people were killing themselves because Donald Trump was elected president. I told this one girl on Facebook, you're going to lay down tonight, you're going to go to sleep, and we'll pray that you will wake up tomorrow, and you're going to do what you're going to do on that next day. Go to work. If you got a husband, take care of your husband, children, or what have you. So you have hope. You know, we keep living. I'm not saying it's not trying times, and I'm not saying it's not going to be trying times, but you still have hope. So she made that statement. I disagree with that statement. But I agree 100% with you. Excuse me. They are not upset about racism. As a matter of fact, I think we can say throughout this term, they haven't even talked about it. You know, that's just and I even think through this term, and this is just my opinion, that, you know, we just dealing with a case of benign neglect. This, you know, we're just not going to talk about the Black community. And I just reminded of some of the speeches that when they would give, it's almost like in front of Black audiences, it's kind of like we were being taken to task. But, you know, that's my opinion. Anyway, I'll mute myself. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure, for sure. We heard that term, Black community, again. Other folks that we have not heard from, you should be with us. Please do not wait until the last minute if you have commentary you would like to share. But all the people that, if you have a hand up and we have not heard from you at all, you should speak now.
Can I be heard?
Yeah.
Oh, was there, we did hear you, Robin, Wisconsin. Was there a female caller there?
Yes.
Okay, you should go ahead.
I can wait.
You sure?
Yes, sir.
Right on. Robin, Wisconsin, thank you for your patience, sir.
Okay, thank you to the female caller. greetings to Gus, the listeners and the callers. And thank you for taking the call. Wanted to know if I could share a small paragraph from Dr. Welsing's book.
Oh, please do.
Okay, this is chapter 5, the symbolism of Christ, the cross, the crucifix, the communion, and Christian holidays, August 1977, February 1979, dedication. This essay is dedicated to all of the Black men who are in greater confinement, prisons, and jails, with the hope that they will be encouraged never to give up the struggle against white supremacy, domination, injustice, once they understand what the struggle is truly all about. Then they never will return to jail, and their behavior no longer will be anti-racist, blind reaction to stress from ignorance, anger, and fear, but effectively counter-racist. Many of these Black men, in their letters to me, also have given me great encouragement, support, and help towards continuing our fight for justice. All Black people are still in confinement. I just have a small report. I know that I was sharing what I was going through at the college, and a lot of the callers was giving me a lot of support, and I just wanted to thank all the callers for the support and just give a small update. The semester closed out. I finished the semester with a 3.8. Just missed a mark of all A's for whatever that's worth. I'm registered for the next semester and looking forward. And thanks for taking the call.
Blacknificent. Dr. Welsing would be extremely proud, and I'm sure would encourage you to nail that 4.0 next semester. The female caller that we just heard from, did you need more time or did you want to speak now? I don't know if you, did you, are you still with us, ma'am? 7781?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Okay. So good evening to you, Gus, and all of the callers. I had a comment and question about the lady that got tackled, abused, and arrested by the race soldier. While scrolling through YouTube and looking at different videos, there are a lot of Black men that are bashing her because of how she took her stance and trying to protect her son. My question to the viewers and also to you, if you have any, is what could have been done You know what I'm saying? If she was wrong for what she did, is there like another codified thing that she could have done to have avoided that? Should she have not have called the police? But then her son was abused. So how then would we? Because me being a mother, if that something like that was to have happened to my child, you know, I am lost for words for the things that that I may want to do, for the things that I may want to say, for how I may want to react, but then at the same time, don't want to have to deal with the backlash of it. Don't want to have to deal with some racist soldier putting his hands on me and taking me away. So are there any advice or suggestions for if a Black mother comes in contact with a situation like that again? I'll wait on the answer. Thanks.
I just want to
can
say,
I be heard?
We can hear you. I just want to make sure that I say first and foremost, Black people criticizing other Black people is one of our favorite activities, and that is Black yep. males criticizing Black males criticizing Black females Black females criticizing Black males. That is an all-day activity that is heavily promoted by the system of white supremacy. That is one, and just to expect that. I wouldn't care what you do. If you're trying to end racism, if you're trying to take care of your child, you can just expect that. That's just how we have been conditioned and groomed. That is the essence of anti-Blackness and why we should really, as best we can, even resist the urge to criticize non-white people, period. That would be one, and don't be surprised when you see a lot of that sort of thing happen. That would be one. Two, in terms of what to do, we can certainly field suggestions. Might even be better to hear from people who actually have children. Do we have any parents? Any people who actually have children? Might be better to hear from them first. Folks that have children, we have any attempted parents with us?
I'm a parent. I mean, my son is older now, but he's in his early 20s now, but I do have that parental experience, of course, with a baby, young child, the whole shebang I would say in regards to that.
So how would you... go ahead.
Go ahead.
My bad.
I'm sorry. No, what was the question you were going to ask? I'm sorry.
I was just going to repeat the question that the female caller just asked, like, as a parent, like, what is the counter-racist suggestion for that sort of situation?
Wow. I think that's really hard because my temper is bad, and I would not stand for somebody putting their hands on my child. I probably would seek to get some sort of retribution, like right there on the spot. It's harder for a woman, simply or a female, I'll say, simply because you know she's not physically capable of doing that. And then, of course, as a Black female, you don't want the added aggravation of potentially having to deal with the police. But for me, as a Black male, attempted father, I would say I would probably end up getting arrested in that situation just because I just wouldn't tolerate something like that. I'm thankful my son never was in a situation where he was ever hit by another white person or any other adult for that matter. But I just know my temper, and I'm just the type of person who would probably want retribution swiftly and right there on the spot. I wouldn't wait to get any intervention at all by the police. I don't believe in dealing with the police. So just the fact that me as, and this is all my life, I just don't believe in dealing with the police unless it's an absolute necessity. That is like the final resort for me. So for me, I would deal with it on the spot. More than likely someone else would call the police. And then from there, I'll probably end up getting arrested. But at that point, I wouldn't mind getting arrested simply because you don't put your hands on my child. And I'm going to show you why you don't put your hands on my child. And that's just my approach, would be my approach. My son has even told me at times, he said he would be scared for anyone else if they ever did anything to him because he knows what I'm probably capable of in a situation like that. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate
it's very hard to speak to that, I would say, in that regard, just simply because it's, as a parent, you just want to protect your child and do the best you can to make sure no one, you know, hurts them or puts them in a situation that can physically harm them or, God forbid, even kill them. So it's really hard, but I would say, knowing myself, that'll probably be my approach, and I'll probably be the one going to jail at that point. Thank you.
Other parents? Do we have other parents with us? Rob, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm a tempted parent. I've actually been to Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas, and I'll just briefly share the experience that I had with I was in an airport, and I'm not even sure what he was. I guess he was security, but he had an AR-15 on his chest, all right? And, man, we had, like, a brief interaction, and I said something to him. And that white man said to me, "Oh, you don't know how I work down here in Texas." And I looked at him, and I knew exactly what he meant. You understand what I'm saying? And, you know, touching on what Rod's response was, I think that would be a typical black male response. And what I'm about to say is not going to be a popular response. But if we don't have a calculated, you know, a calculated response, I think the counter-racist response would be to take that one on the chin, man, because let's say...
Metaphor, but that I'm pointing that out because this is important. This is important. This is what I mean about the details. So the counter-racist response would be
to not not really pursue it. Let me see. I think the proper response would to be just to be as safe as possible. And keeping you and your child safe. And what I would like to put out, let's say the counter-racist response is to get swift retribution. The thought that I had, like I've been to prison before, 5 years, and like right now, knowing what I know, I'm terrified to be back in them people's custody because I feel like I might not make it out alive. You understand what I'm saying? So now if you touch this white person, now you got to go in the hands of white people. Quote, unquote, you know, got to take you to jail. Via Sandra Bland. I'll mute myself. Thank you.
One thought that came to mind, and the reason that I'm not really commenting as much on this is because I don't have children. But that being said, one thought that did come to mind in terms of thinking ahead, right? If I am a black parent, and this is like highlighted, bold letter, all caps, particularly if you are a single black parent, attempted parent, that situation cannot happen at all. Because if you get arrested and go to jail, that means your children could very easily end up in foster care. You do not want that to happen at all in terms of, like, thinking long term, which is why I know for a lot of people who have said, wow, I don't know if I could be a parent under these conditions. I totally get you. But that's the type of scenario you would have to think about, like any sort of situation like this, because it happens so frequently. I think I've played at least three or four different scenarios where parents, a black parent, ended up being arrested because they were trying to defend their child from racism, whether they went to the school and someone at the school was being racist and they called the police and the parent got arrested. The situation that you just heard right there, that happens every day. That's what it is to be an attempted parent and you end up getting arrested trying to protect your child. Like, it is serious to think about, and it happens all the time. Do we have any other parents here who have, you know, counter-racist suggestion or have had to deal with something like this? Like, you know, you have already been through that and kind of know, okay, this is the type of thing. This is how I would respond if someone put their hand on my child, a white person, a white adult.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is the female caller from New York.
I have never had a white person put their hands on my son, but I'm big on making reports and getting things in writing. So, you know, with my fear of white men, what I would do would be to, if I needed to take pictures, take as many pictures that I can on the scene. If there was a witness, I would try to get the witness's statement. And I wouldn't call the police out to the scene. You know, a whole lot of stuff happens when we call the cops to our homes. They shoot down our doors. They shoot the people, you know, they terrorize the people in the house. But we never think to take the situation to the police station. So, I mean, that's my first thought when the young lady asked the question. If you take it to their turf, not that nothing would, you know, not that they wouldn't say, hey, you crazy nigga, we putting you in jail right here. Thank you for coming. It saved us some gas. Not that that wouldn't happen, but if you're serious about the situation and if you're articulate and you got everything written down and you got that person's name and address and phone number and description of what happened and a witness and you march yourself down to the police station to make a report and then request that they all come to the scene to talk to the person, it might work out a little better. You know, that's just my little brain thinking right now. I could be totally incorrect, but it just seems to me that a lot of things happen when we invite them to us rather than us getting the stuff together and going to them. Yeah, they're going to shoot it through food. I'm sorry. I hate to say that. They're going to, they may put all kinds of holes in your story. They're going to, you know, the same tragic situation could go down. But it might be a little less violent if we bring the issue to them and then ask, you know, decently for an investigation to be done and ask them, let's go back to the scene. I'd like an officer to come back with me and corroborate my report. That's all. I could be wrong, but that was what I thought of. I'll mute my line.
Very logical. Other people, other parents, I want to get, if we have people that are not parents, you can share as well, but just I want to make sure if we have parents, if you have gone through this or you have thoughts on how you would deal with this, would love to hear it. And I did also just wanted to make sure I added in addition to that, some people as a part of their counter-racist code, theirs is, I mean, unless it's somebody's going to die right now type of thing, I'm not calling the police under any circumstances, just for the reasons that the female caller in New York just laid out. So I suspect some of those people, this situation would apply since no one was about to die. It's not like the young black child in the situation was in life-threatening danger imminently. So I suspect for some folks this would have been a situation, no, we are not calling enforcement officers for any reason. Was there a parent that was going to speak up? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think yourself and the last caller was heading in a logical direction, very logical direction. The first thing comes to my mind is whether or not there was, first of all, an emergency. Number two, whether or not my child was the magnitude of the contact. Was it damaging other than his or my ego as far as that concerned? Because that right there gets a lot of non-white black people, especially black males, in trouble, even to death or prison for long periods of time. And then, you know, while you are sitting in that jail cell, you have a lot of time to think about alternatives. And that's probably, you don't want to go through that process. I would say, along with the last caller, think about the process of something like a restraining order, which can be obtained. You can at least be able to speak about the issue and that person would have to show up to defend themselves. The person that touched your child, as far as restraining order is concerned. And those are some of the things that I would think about, you know, along those terms. Also, what I did in real life with my own offspring is shared with him codification, not always necessarily directly counter-racist codification, but just codification in general. And now he's 20 years old, and I must say he's actually a far better person than the retired firefighter is, as far as being very courteous, being aware of his environment, to whereas I've never heard him do any shouting or anything like that. Stays well under control, a lot better than what I do. That doesn't 100% keeps you out of trouble, but it does lessen the chance that you would get yourself in some situation similar to the one that we are talking about. Those are some of the things that just wanted to share with everybody. Thank you.
Logical. We have other parents with us. If we have parents that are spectating right now, that is not acceptable. This is one, if you're a black parent and, you know, you have had to think about this, you have experienced this, if, you know, this is the type of thing that you think about in terms of how would I deal with this as an attempted parent who has some understanding of racism and counter-racism, this is one you should share. Because I think the female who called in, I think she asked the question earnestly, looking for some input, just trying to get a better understanding. And I think it's for sure something we should be very serious and, you know, eager to talk about since we, you know, are trying to solve this problem. And we do have people here who are parents. We have any other parents who wanted to share? Lady in the rock, did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I totally was spectating. I apologize. So in response to the question that was asked to parents, there is no real right way to handle these situations. You try to be as codified as possible, but the more you try to advocate for your children, including your black child, the more that angry label will be put on you that was discussed earlier, the more resistance you will get. My son in particular, has been has had his hands placed on him by white males, probably more than what I know of. Before I started homeschooling, he went to preschool, and when he was getting his assessment for kindergarten, because I was wavering with homeschooling, assessment day, he was grabbed by the collar very hard and yanked back, and I was not present, my daughter was, by a white male, but I can tell by the look in his eyes that he was assaulted, and I knew because I wasn't present that white people were just going to bombard me with a whole bunch of lies, and because there was no physical scarring, that there was pretty much almost nothing I could do except take him out of school and to say, you know what, I'm not going to play this game. He's not going to go to this school. Because the terms that were thrown around, I was not going to be able to counter those, which were, oh, it's for safety. Oh, he was running. I thought he was going to hurt himself. And it was all lies, but those terms, I knew I was not going to win as far as trying to have actions taken against them. And I knew it was just simply my child needed to use the bathroom, which I told them, but I wasn't going to go anywhere with it. Even this week, I tried to advocate for my son. Another child humped on him, and I was met even by black people with anger for, I want a report. I want something to be done about this. This is incorrect that someone did this to my child. He is obviously uncomfortable, And this could have turned violent, you know, with kids fighting each other. It could have really went negative. And that's what I was told. I was told I was overboard. And I'm noticing a theme with advocating for him is all of the aggression and attitude and snappiness, that only works with other black people. If I am to try that in the presence of white people or white males in particular, I'm going to take some serious consequences, and I am not going to get any resolve. It will, that type of behavior will be ended as quickly as possible, so I don't even attempt to, when advocating for any of either of my children, put myself in a situation like I'm going to assault someone or I'm going to, you know, offend them because they offended me, because it's just not going to get anywhere with white people. And I really want to say it's just try to be as codified as possible, but there is no quote-unquote right way to handle advocating for your children because they're black, you're black, and people just want you to shut up. And so that's pretty much my comment.
Wow. Good point about the just engaging in histrionics or thinking that you can just talk loud and aggressive. That generally is very ineffective with it's, in fact, it's been my experience, whites, very easy for them to handle. They already know how to deal with it. In fact, generally, that's just one phone call and boop, that's all over with. So they don't, that's nothing for them to deal with. The person that dialed in 6102 and the caller at 6900, are either of you all parents that were calling in to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
I also agree with the firefighter and the young lady that stated that to go to the police station opposed to having them come to your home. The first reaction, I have a son and a daughter. The first reaction, of course, is to protect your child, and you want to hurt them. But under the system that we live in, we have to live in a codified fashion, and we have to teach our children also to carry themselves in a codified manner. I decided last year that I will never call the police. The only time I would call the police is if I need paperwork done for as far as calling to my home, because you're calling for help, but it can flip to be very fatal when you call them to your home. So I agree, and I think it's a good idea to try to stay as codified as much as you can, and to go to the police station to explain what happened and for them to investigate. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Awesome.
Can I be heard?
You can. I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss because we had newer people that dialed in. The caller at 6900. Are you there? 6900?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, this is 6900.
Go ahead.
Yep. How you doing, Gus? Hello to the rest of the callers. This is Jay from New York. I totally agree with the previous caller, the firefighter. I'm a attempted parent of two young black males. And number one, I think it really goes back to trying to codify your children as much as possible. And number two, just trying to de-escalate the situation. I totally agree. I'm an attempted parent in a single father type of scenario. I'm divorced. So I know if I'm carted away for kind of letting the other side try and come up and kind of tout with the, you know, race soldier, that takes me out of the situation, and then my boys can be terrorized even worse while I'm gone. in the scenario. So in looking at this scenario specifically, I do my best to codify my boys at every instance. We're going through a situation right now with their school. There was a terrorized situation with my older son, a white child, terrorized him on the during recess. It's been 7 weeks now. I've been going up and back and forth to the school. I've been told kids do this and this happens during recess, even though there was a teacher that saw the entire incident. Again, all that we can do is do our best to try and get things documented. They're going to try and protect their individual racist children in the system. And I think that we don't have that much leverage in the system. So the best that we can codify and keep them away from our home. So I think that's the sentiment. Try and keep them away from your home as much as possible. Going to the police station is a great idea. But again, I think it would be starting with codifying the children, keeping them away from the media that's kind of telling them to go out and show themselves and puff up their chest. And do your best to kind of keep any of the race soldiers away from your home residence.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Thank both of you all for dialing in. I was going to check with, did we miss any parents? Any parents that we have that wanted to respond? Okay. The female caller, did you get, I guess, satisfactory responses to your question, or do you feel like you still didn't, people didn't really respond to your question?
Yes. The New York caller, she opened up my eyes to a whole other level of taking things into your own hands because I already don't, I think I've called the police maybe once before. I don't like to call the police at all. So when she mentioned to just take it on their turf, it made a lot more sense to do it like that if I feel like I have to. Now, mind you, I will find other alternatives to doing something like that if I can't avoid it. But I am very good at taking notes, keeping records, all of those good things. So, yes, she made a lot of sense. It was very logical and constructive. The firefighter touched on it as well. And I thank everybody that pitched in their opinion. It truly helped. So, thank you.
Grand, serious conversation. We pretty much did our 3 hours, and we are going to be back tomorrow, but I'll check to see if we had one final comment before we go. I did just want to say, it was 1842. We'll get her because I did want to appreciate. She, I think, was the only person who mentioned the commentary about the person on death row, Mr. Anthony Ray Hinton. He did 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit because of the system of white supremacy. Unless I'm in error, I don't think my memory could be failing, but I don't think anybody else mentioned made comment about that. But that segment, when I was listening to it, as I said, there were things I didn't even play this week. I had a lot, which is rare for the holiday week. I was listening to that clip, and I wasn't going to play it. And he got to, and I mean, that's what I mean about the abundance of things that I had to play from. That's the system of white supremacy. I listened to that clip. I was not going to play it. I was just listening just for myself. And he got to the part about the queen, and I had no idea even how to process. It was black mental health is all I could think. Like it was devastating just listening to what happened to him on just how the system of white supremacy can totally, when Dr. Welsing, when she says black people do not qualify for black mental health under this system, great illustration right there. Tragic illustration right there, but I think that is the exact point that she's getting at. And we are all in greater confinement. That's just a much more acute example, but all of us are in confinement under the system of white supremacy. And I mean, that's why you have to have all these strategies for not calling the police, because they do not show up to say, oh, we're here to help with a smile. That's not what happens for black people. I mean, it ends up being exactly what happened to that mom in Dallas-Fort Worth. So that segment,
I'm dumbfounded with all of it. He had quite a bit more to say there. Unfortunately, with some forgiveness talk at the end that we always hear black people talking about forgiving. So, you know, I could put that to the side. But it was stunning. And I take everything that he said in that clip, him leaving his body and going to have tea with the Queen of England. And I thought 1842, she gave just brilliant commentary. But my mind went to Nelson Mandela. And when people call him a sellout and an Uncle Tom and a traitor and what a no good coon he is, and he's dead now, but I still hear this from black people all the time. They had a program in South Africa where they spent an hour talking about whether Nelson Mandela is a sellout. He was on trial for his life in the 1960s for his work with Mkhonto-we Sizwe in working against white supremacy in South Africa, known as apartheid. He spent nearly 30 years in jail, just like Anthony Ray Hinton. Do we think that something could have happened to him mentally? Do we think that, you know, he was just that special, that he didn't have any of those same problems, that his black mental health was sterling after spending 30 years in greater confinement? Is that what we think about Nelson Mandela? I can speak for myself. That's not what I think. None of us qualifies for black mental health, and that is evident in a variety of ways. 1842, were you going to get a final comment in before we wrap things up?
Thank you for checking back in. I just wanted to say one thing because I don't think we talked about it a lot this time around, but it was very interesting to hear the piece about Germany and their version of the quote-unquote opera. I'm forgetting their name right now. But I knew it was something silly, another made up word. But seriously, that we are looking at refinement, and I just like, you know, just to say it out there in case someone listens to, you know, the archive or something, but global refinement, and I could be totally incorrect, like, I'm not a scholar at this at all, but someone that was saying, that was speaking in that clip, was saying that this is the social media savvy or something like that, like they're privy to social media so they know how to create an image for themselves. That's exactly what we're looking at. And then I don't think that it's smart or wise to, they're aware, like Germans are aware that they can't go and be hyper nationalistic because they will get a lot of backlash. Like, white people are intelligent. I keep reminding myself about that. Like, it's my defense mechanism to say that they are not. So they know they can't do that. But at the same time, we have the Amazon show where there's a whole lot of Hitler, Nazi propaganda being promoted. I don't know how the viewing population is in Germany, but I know over here it seems to be a big thing. The quote-unquote alt-right, like, just global white supremacy refinement. And they are going to look very polished and very like, what's his face, Spencer here, and are going to be really slick. But I think that's what we're looking at is refinement. And I just wanted to say that because I think it's a bit important. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. In Germany, I don't know if they have television programs, but I think they just went right to the source. They just reissued Mein Kampf in Germany this year. It was not, you could get a copy, but it was not like widespread, easy access publication in Germany, but they reissued it this year. So I think they just went, forget all of these. She was referencing the Amazon TV program, The Man in the High Castle, which is great TV. I think it's in season 2 and justifies them putting up all this Nazi white supremacist paraphernalia to promote the show. And the show is science fiction. It postulates a future where Hitler wins World War II. And so they have taken over North America. That's what the show is about. Yes. We will be here tomorrow. Dr. Niana Rasayan, he was last with us for the night of the election. Matter of fact, he was last with us as they were calling live the election, and it was announced that Donald Trump indeed had won. He was with us live on air to give commentary. So we will get his assessment now that we've all had time to reflect and discuss that, as well as all of the deaths. We normally do an end of the year program. As of about May of this year, I did not want to do that. Well, number one, the end of the year program is normally on New Year's Eve, but that will be next Saturday, so we'll already be here for the compensatory call-in. But that notwithstanding, I normally do a wrap-up program. We kind of make an assessment, counter-racist review of what happened over the past 12 months. And as of about May, I knew I did not want to do that because so many black people died this year. That would have been the show, just how many people, how many prominent black people who devoted their time and energy in a constructive manner to confronting racism passed away in 2016. The list is enormous. 2014 was a similar year when we lost a lot of prominent black people, but no comparison to this year. I think Dr. Rasayan will be able to touch on that. And also reflections on the Dylan Storm Roof trial, because I don't think that got nearly as much attention as it should have. We'll have time for that as well. Probably even some of the suggestions that came up. Dr. Rasayan is a parent. We can get his thoughts on the situation in Fort Worth as well in terms of what's there, particularly because I know that he is one who always gets vocal and talks up about black self-respect and us not just, you know, accepting and tolerating this sort of thing. So it'd be great to hear his thoughts as a parent in terms of what he would recommend or suggest for that sort of situation. But normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in if you're with, you know, relatives, family, friends, whatever you're doing for December 25th. You can tune in. We'll be here, ask questions, or you can listen. We'll be looking forward. You can feel free to share if something goes down. If you're able to have constructive dialogue with your family, tune in to share that as well. That's always good to hear. If you have questions, problems, if you can't find something in the archives, if you have a guest suggestion, feel free to email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I will try to help out as best I can, respond. If I get confused, because sometimes people will send me an email and I think I have responded, or they will be similar requests for similar programs, and I'll get confused. So if you don't hear back, just drop an email again. And then sometimes two people send things to Facebook and all over the place, so it can get confused. If it's a request, something serious that you're trying to discuss, send it to the email account, untiljustice@gmail.com, and feel free to just drop another line if something happens, because sometimes they do, the messages do end up in spam and that sort of thing as well. Anywho, thanks everyone for tuning in. It was great. I unmuted Thomas in New York, and I just didn't hear from him. He's been unmuted for the very beginning of the program. Thomas in New York, are you there, sir? I think your line was unmuted the whole time. I'm pretty sure I'd unmuted your line, just making sure I didn't kick him to the curb, or I don't even want to, making sure I did not deny him the opportunity to speak. Are you there, Thomas, in New York, or? Yeah, I thought his line was open the whole time. I was pretty sure it was. If the technology somehow interfered, or if I messed up, my apologies. If you are able to dial in tomorrow, we will make sure that you have an opportunity to share your views. But I did double check your line again just now, and I'm still not hearing anything, so. At any rate, with that, we will wrap things up. We, again, will be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll also be here on Tuesday. We will have Glenda Gilmore, white woman. She wrote the book Gender and Jim Crow. Fascinating, about white women's role in maintaining white supremacy in the state of North Carolina. Even deals with the Wilmington riot. Chris Everett did that great documentary we talked about this time last year. And then we'll be here on Wednesday. We'll have Chantel, she's been on the program before, Cowbell, she has a white mother, black father, and one of our more recent callers, she also has a white mother and a black father, and their stories are almost identical, which is wild for so many reasons, because Chantel is already a twin, and it's like now she has another twin. Identical stories, and I think it's important because it shows the patterns, particularly it shows how these white women, their white mothers, practice racism, white supremacy. And you'll be able to see the symmetry. So you'll know this is not accidental. This is about what you can expect with these tragic arrangements and how they function as race soldiers and mothers of non-white children practicing racism the whole time. But that'll be Wednesday, all normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Again, those sobriety checkpoints will be set up. So sobriety would be best, particularly this weekend and on into 2017. If you got to go out, if you got to get behind that wheel,
You got to be in a vehicle, period, as a driver, passenger, even if you're going to be a pedestrian. I contend you probably don't want to be under the influence and have that be the time that you bump into the enforcement officer that threw this black female or two black females on the ground, this black mother in Fort Worth, Dallas, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers. I don't think being intoxicated or high or whatever the other substance is, I don't think that that's going to help us neutralize that situation and make it out safely. The evidence would tend to suggest we would do it better giving sobriety a chance. That way we can think clearly, make great decisions to try to keep ourselves safe, any other non-white people that we are responsible for. With that, thanks again. Remain safe. We'll be here in 24 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.